Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome along, everybody. We are going to jump right to the chase this evening. I have on the line with me right now, graciously agreeing to have a conversation with us about a very, very, very important thing that has happened today. An absolutely stunning study has been announced. It has been published in the peer-reviewed journal Science. And the fact of the matter is, what this study indicates is that mountaintop removal is pervasive. It is irreversible. And this is real science. This is the undeniable stuff. And I have several of the co-authors of the study online with me now. I want to go straight to them so that we waste no time whatsoever. On the line with me now is Dr. Margaret Palmer. Dr. Palmer, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. Okay. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. Also with us, Dr. Michael Hendricks, Dr. Emily Bernhardt, and Dr. A.D. Lemley, all of whom had a hand in the creation of this study. Dr. Palmer, and each of you, when you speak, if you would just identify yourselves, please. Let me ask you first, Dr. Palmer, how did such a comprehensive study take shape and come to be?
Well, all of the authors are very dedicated scientists who had expertise in specific areas that are relevant to the issue of mountaintop mining. And it became clear to myself and to my close collaborator, Dr. Bernhardt, that the relevant science related to the issue of mountaintop mining had not been brought together in a way that could deeply analyze what was available out there, what we know and what we don't know, using the peer-reviewed literature. And so we contacted those experts from hydrology, toxicology, public health, et cetera, that could work together to analyze existing data and anything that had been peer-reviewed to ask, what do we know about the impacts of mountaintop mining environmentally and in terms of health, if there are impacts, and what would we find? And so we set out to do that. It took us about 6 months to complete the analysis of the existing peer-reviewed studies, as well as to analyze recently obtained data set that we had on water chemistry.
Was there a great deal of data out there for your analysis in terms of those pre-existing peer-reviewed studies?
It depends on which aspect of the issue that you look at. There is a fairly extensive amount of data available on water chemistry that has not been brought to the forefront to a large extent in some of the more accessible peer-reviewed literature. But much of this information exists in very different sources, again, all of it peer-reviewed science journals, that had not been brought together. And that is essentially what we did with this particular study.
Well, since this does bring together so many different fields, Dr. Palmer, if you would sort of take the lead on this and guide us through the process of what you've discovered, let's start with your particular field of expertise, and then we will move to Dr. Hendricks, Dr. Bernhardt, and Dr. Lemley, because what I get from reading this is that there is no aspect of anything that was studied within your research that mountaintop removal does not have a rather pernicious effect on. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, that's a very fair statement. And I should say at the outset that, first of all, this research was that we did was extensively peer-reviewed. It's probably the most critical peer-review process I've ever been to in my nearly 30-year career in science. Authors that are involved here, most of us have never met one another or worked together. None of the authors are advocates for the mountaintop mining. And in fact, we had to sign statements before the journal Science would even consider our submission to them to indicate that we were not supported by any particular group, nor did we have any preconceived ideas about what direction this should take. My own area of expertise is in mitigation and stream restoration, and that's how I first got involved in this, was looking at to what extent do the kinds of approaches that are used to mitigate for any potential impact support, how are they supported by current science? Is it up to date with what's going on in restoration ecology and so forth? And it became very clear to me quickly that the methods that are being used or proposed to mitigate for the impact are not only ineffective, but some of them are actually outside what I would consider the science of restoration ecology. I'll just speak very briefly about the areas that are the authors that aren't present with us right now, and that is we brought in Dr. Bill Schlesinger, who's the president of the Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies, a National Academy member who's an expert on forest biogeochemistry and soils and reclamation. And, he reached conclusions based on his analysis of existing data that that regrowth of vegetation is not only very sparse on virtually every site that has been looked at, but that forest regrowth and full recovery to the level of pre-mining conditions for the forest would be on the order of, 10,000 years. So we also had a hydrologist, Dr. Keith Eshelman, who's done extensive research on the effect of mining, surface mining on hydrology, and it's very clear that the peak floods and the magnitude and timing of floods increases very significantly in streams and waterways that are left below mining sites. And then I think it would probably make sense to me now to turn it over to some of my co-authors that are present here to talk a little bit about their findings. And I should say some of them have spent many, many years looking into this issue, unlike some of the work that I have done. So I think I'll start with turning it to Dr. Bernhardt from Duke University, who's a biogeochemist and has looked very closely at the chemical and water quality impacts of this issue.
Okay, great. Dr. Bernhardt, thank you, first of all, for joining us. It's a pleasure to meet you at this attenuated distance, and I really appreciate the work that you have done. If you would, please, just give us an overview of what your findings were.
Okay, so this is Emily Bernhardt. I'm a professor of biology at Duke University, and I've been really interested in the effects of mountaintop mining on aquatic ecosystems. And most of my work to date has been looking at how land use changes in watersheds affect stream chemistry, and how we can use stream chemistry to tell us something about the way the watershed is working or not working. So what I did in preparation for this study was to first synthesize the literature on what we know so far about mountaintop mining impacts, and second, try to get new data from the West Virginia DEP about what the water quality impacts really are on the ground right now. And so I guess there are a few things that are sort of my summary from those analyses. The first is that I think the most well-understood and least contentious issue associated with mountaintop mining is that we are, in fact, destroying streams that are buried in overburden from mining activities or converted into sediment ponds. And the best and most conservative estimate to date is that over 1,500 miles of streams in the Appalachians have been destroyed as a result of mountaintop mining. So this means that we've basically lost those ecosystems. And there's been a lot of attention to this in terms of regulations and policy.
Well, I'm loath to interrupt Dr. Bernhardt, but when you say lost, I take it that you're using a very concise scientific approach to the word, insofar as lost means gone forever. I mean, is that what you mean?
I mean, they're gone for the future of our generation and subsequent generations, for as far down as we can imagine. So when you bury a stream in hundreds of meters of unconsolidated rock, that stream doesn't exist anymore. And I don't think anybody argues with that at all. And in fact, it's a big part of the mitigation of current permitting, is that that has to be compensated for. And I guess what we argue with as experts on restoration, both Margaret and I are that current techniques to basically build new streams on old mine soil are completely insufficient to in any way compensate us for the loss of those really important ecosystems. We can talk more about that if you want, but I think I'd like to move on to what I think are the less discussed issues associated with mountaintop mining. That's an important part of the permitting process and been an important part of the legal challenges to mountaintop mining. But in addition to that, there are these downstream effects of mountaintop mining that are very clear from the data we put together in this paper, and that you have a whole lot of rock that has basically been pushed into the valleys. You now have large amounts of rock surface area available for weathering, and that results in the production of large quantities of sulfate, calcium, magnesium, and trace metals that then contribute to very high conductivity, high total suspended solids, and toxicity for downstream ecosystems. And so what we did is gather data on more than 1,000 streams in West Virginia that were sampled by the West Virginia DEP, showing that the more sulfate you see in the stream, and we can tie sulfate very directly to the extent of mining activity in the watershed, the more sulfate you see in the stream, the more the higher the concentrations are of associated trace metals, and the lower the diversity of the invertebrate community. And you probably see a lot of press on the issue of mayflies versus miners.
Yes.
Mayflies, very sensitive insects living in streams. And I think regardless of what you hear about mayflies for their own sake, they are really canaries in the coal mine, if you will, in terms of what this pollution is doing to the health of these ecosystems, the quality of this water, not just for the mayflies, but for the people that are drinking this water, eating fish out of this water, and spending time recreating.
Well, and because they are, in fact, a marker species, are they not?
They are a very important indicator, and they're used as such throughout the United States as measures of ecosystem health and of water quality.
So, okay, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I was going to say then that the next sort of pieces of this are that one of the things that's being ignored is the cumulative impact. So every single additional mine that occurs in the watershed is going to contribute additional pollutants. And so we have this additive effect. Every new mine you add adds new trace metals, new sulfates, new calcium, new magnesium, new conductivity issues, which all contribute to pollution of downstream rivers. And the evidence that exists right now suggests that that's not going to stop for any time in the near future. So we're talking about decades of persistent pollution by sulfate and associated trace metals coming out of these mine sites. So it's both cumulative, it's resulting from every single mine that you add in a watershed, and persistent over time. I think Dennis Lindley can speak specifically to the most well-understood constituent within that solution, which is selenium.
Indeed, because, and I think selenium should be a very important part of our conversation this evening, simply because there's been a lot of debate around it as to whether or not it's even that dangerous. I personally am bamboozled by the idea that someone would think that it isn't, but that argument has certainly been made within the mining community. Doctor, as you looked at these the impacts on these streams, and the downstream effects, what is there any way of quantifying what distance downstream actually means?
That's a really great question. I wish we had better data than we do about that. There has not been a comprehensive analysis of the extent of mining, and there's been no attempt to associate the sampling done by the West Virginia DEP with distance from valley fills or mining activity. And so that is definitely a shortcoming of the data set as it exists today. I can tell you anecdotally, and I think Dennis can expound upon this, that there certainly is evidence that valley fills lead to significant biotic degradation kilometers downstream, and pretty, really, probably the strongest evidence is from the Mud River terms of selenium contamination in a reservoir more than 12, 15 kilometers downstream of the Hobet line. That's probably the best studied current longitudinal impact of mountaintop mining. I don't think that's going to be unique if more studies are done.
Well, in the final analysis, are we using, perhaps the best way to put it would be, are we engaging in wishful thinking when we actually talk about terms like mitigation based on the research that you have released?
I would say that the mitigation within the permits that I've seen has been focused on building habitat, building new stream habitat, or trying to recreate the vegetation. And in both of those attempts, there are serious constraints to be able to accomplish anything. So I'm most familiar with the stream mitigation work, and I haven't seen any evidence that we can even get water to be in these channels, much less make them be functioning stream ecosystems.
That's rather a damning statement, Doctor.
Margaret wants to expound on that.
Well, I was just going to say, this is Margaret Palmer, that one of the important points is that even if you could get all of the vegetation to grow back, that is the native forest, there's no evidence that this is the case, you still will have the water quality issues downstream. And I think this might be a good time, Bob, to consider us hearing from Dr. Limley about some of those serious issues, but I'll leave it to you.
No, I think you're absolutely correct, Dr. Palmer. Dr. Limley, could you address this?
Yes, I've spent over 30 years investigating the effects of selenium from coal mining and a lot of other sources, for that matter, on aquatic systems. And the situation with mountaintop mining is very interesting and very dangerous. Selenium is a deadly poison to fish and wildlife. It doesn't take very much to start a process of bioaccumulation in the aquatic food chain. And the end result is that it accumulates in fish tissues and it causes reproductive failure. Essentially, it passes from adults to the offspring and their eggs. And when those eggs hatch, the young fish are deformed and distorted in a variety of ways. They may be missing eyes. They may have deformed heads. Their spines may be twisted out of shape. And those young fish will die. And what we're seeing in West Virginia, specifically with the Hobet mine complex, is that kilometers downstream, the waters from that mine are actually causing bioaccumulation of selenium in a reservoir and causing deformities in the fish. And that's one of the few locations where there's actually any monitoring data for fish whatsoever. So as we begin to look further, and I think this was pointed out, that we need better comprehensive monitoring and information on lots of these sites so we can gain a better handle on what's actually going on. But what we do know is that from a variety of these sites, we have water concentrations of selenium that are high enough to cause problems in the fish in those streams and reservoirs downstream of the mines. We don't have good monitoring data to indicate what the actual spatial distribution of the elevated selenium might be in the fish tissues. But we know that selenium is highly toxic to fish, and it doesn't take very much to accumulate to a level that can cause serious problems in the fish.
Is there an issue of transference into the human population, Doctor?
Yes, there is. Actually, there is a consumption advisory in effect for 2010 for the state of West Virginia for streams and reservoirs downstream of some of the mountaintop mining complexes. So there is a recognition that, in fact, the transfer of selenium into humans through the diet or through consumption of sport fish is a hazard in West Virginia.
To what extent, so far we've discussed surface water, flowing water issues. Does this also percolate into the water table itself?
Yes, it does, and that raises another issue in terms of long-term effects and cumulative effects, because not only is it an immediate concern in terms of selenium leaching out of the waste rock piles, the valley fills, but percolation into groundwater would essentially create a plume of potentially toxic levels of selenium that could subsequently leach or transport itself into surface waters for a long, long period of time.
With that being the case, do you have any within your data, Doctor, Are you able to quantify as a function of time how long these selenium events have been entering watersheds?
Well, we don't have any good information from eastern sites in terms of in terms of West Virginia specifically, because most of these mines are relatively young as compared to mine sites in the western states. But from information from those western states, some of those mine spoil sites that are nearly 100 years old are still leaching selenium at very high concentrations. So based on that information, I would predict that the valley fields in West Virginia and other states would continue to essentially leak dangerous concentrations of selenium into waterways for decades, if not centuries, to come.
And are you aware of any realistic mitigation strategies that can prevent this from happening, or is this simply something that West Virginia and Appalachia generally will have to deal with? I'm talking about the stuff that's already happened.
Well, once a spoils pile, in other words, a valley fill, starts to leach selenium, it's, you know, absorbing rainwater, it creates its own little mini aquifer, you might say, internally inside the waste dump. And that material is going to continue to generate selenium for a long time. So in terms of mitigating that, there's really nothing that can be done to stop that. So it's virtually inevitable.
I asked the question because I have been told personally by representatives of the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection that that their permitting process requires that when selenium concentrations are identified through core sampling and so forth, that they require segregation onto what they refer to as dry areas. That's expecting that to keep it keep selenium out of the water supply is unrealistic, if I understand you correctly.
It's absolutely unrealistic because there's virtually no way to assure a dry site in terms of anything short of underlayment with a composite liner. Collection of any leachate and treatment of that. Of course, that's not taking place anywhere, so that's a virtual impossibility.
You described the effects on fish, and you said that there is a transference issue, Dr. Lemley, into the human population. What effects does selenium have on a human being?
Well, it has several potential effects in terms of the things we know that can happen. It creates several toxic effects in terms of loss of hair, loss of nails, poison of internal organs, and at its most extreme, which we don't have clear documentation of, certainly inferring for fish and mammals and birds, we would suspect that there may be a potential for birth defects in young children.
Dear Lord, and as part of this study, then within your field of expertise, are you making an I understand from what Dr. Palmer said that you entered this, you entered into this study with rather profound and strict guidelines. You know, not advocating this is real science. This is simple scientific inquiry. But you came to conclusions. Is one of those conclusions the simple fact that mountaintop removal it cannot be quote unquote safely done?
I think that's a fair statement. We don't have any evidence in our research and documentation that suggests that there is a way to do it safely, given the environmental impacts we see.
Bob, this is Margaret Palmer. I just might add that when we started out this study, we really didn't know what direction it was going to take. And what ended up happening is that the authors sort of independently reached the conclusion that the evidence was so overwhelming, it's basically like smoking and cancer, that it's so clear-cut that we took the unusual step of making a policy recommendation. I think this is a good point to segue, though, to Dr. Hendricks, because we've heard, from Dr. Lemley about some of the potential health impacts, but Dr. Hendricks has looked more broadly at population-level consequences of this. So perhaps I could suggest we hear from him.
I think that's a great idea. Dr. Hendricks, welcome to the program, and thank you as well for joining us. As a West Virginian, I am familiar with your work perhaps more than that of Dr. Lemley's or Dr. Bernhardt's, and I'm also familiar with Dr. Palmer's work. But since your focus, your previous focus has gotten more notice, perhaps here in West Virginia, I am somewhat aware. With that being the preface, and let me just tell you that I live in Fayette County, West Virginia, with my family and our grandchildren. We live near a mountaintop removal site. So it came to me with really quite chilling horror when I read some of your previous findings. Is what you've done with this study an amplification and expansion upon your previous work?
It's more of a summary of what we had done and reported before, but now we're linking it more directly to additional information on the environmental impacts of the mining activity so that we can link the two together. For example, selenium is one of the many elements that are present in trace levels associated with coal and that can enter groundwater and surface water sources, and it can also be released into the air through the use of explosives and the removal of the overburden above coal seams and mountaintop mining. We do have a more recent study that we're working on right now that documents that, in fact, there are higher rates of low birth weight infants associated with heavier levels of mining, and that there are higher rates of congenital abnormalities. Dr. Limley had suggested that that might be a result of some selenium exposure like you expect to see in fish, and we do find evidence that is consistent with that possibility. And as the other research has shown before, there is well-established, very clear evidence of higher rates of a number of serious chronic types of health conditions, a cardiovascular disease, respiratory disease, kidney disease, some forms of cancer that are related in a dose-response fashion to higher levels of mining activity. Also evidence of higher types of dental problems and poor learning outcomes among children in relationship to more mining activity. So we don't understand all of the links yet between how the environmental impacts work and what the health outcomes are, but the evidence is extremely suggestive and accumulating and quite strong, I think, that health outcomes among people that live in mining areas are negatively impacted by activities of the mining industry.
Dr. Hendricks, when you say mining activities within the context of this discussion in this paper, are you limiting yourself exclusively to mountaintop removal mining activities, or is this broader in terms of the general universe of coal mining in Appalachia?
I think the effects are partly a consequence of mountaintop mining and other forms of surface mining because of the greater disturbance that takes place for surface water and also for air quality around those mining activities. But I also think that there are other aspects of the industry where we have some pretty good information that there is also environmentally compromised air or water quality around coal processing facilities, for example, and around some of the transportation activities. It's difficult to try to tease out effects of one specific type of activity compared to another because they're all so closely interrelated geographically. But I think the evidence is pretty clear that different components of the activity have effects. So it's not all mountaintop mining, no. I think it is partly that, but also partly other aspects of the industry.
If I may ask you, Dr. Hendricks, for someone who lives, say, near an active site where there is ongoing blasting on a day-to-day basis, what sorts of toxins, what sorts of chemicals are they being exposed to?
Well, that's going to depend on what they use in the explosives themselves. Those can include a number of types of fuels and chemical compounds. It can also include whatever is in the overburden itself, which can vary from site to site. So it's difficult to say with certainty based on the information that we have now, but it would be a combination of whatever was in the rock in the soil above the seams plus whatever is used in the explosives.
And suffice to say on a general basis, those things that you're describing are not good for human consumption?
Yes, there's plenty of evidence that a variety of trace elements that are present in and around coal are either toxicants or carcinogens, and that some of the chemicals that are used in explosives and also in the coal processing and the transportation activities are also harmful to human health. That's clearly established.
You also describe effects in coal communities, and I just asked you a question about someone living right next to an active site. Similar to my previous question about what downstream means, is there data to suggest how far is there a safe distance one may be from a mountaintop removal site?
Well, from the perspective of potential water exposures, I don't know that there would be if there's transport down whatever that watershed is to where people are living and where their wells might be. From an air quality perspective, I think it's probably more localized. We've done some air quality assessments where we've taken some measures at varying distances from either a mountaintop site or from a processing facility or from a truck haul route. And you can see pretty clearly that the levels of particulate matter are highest nearest the site. And when you get to about a mile away, they start to approach more like background levels. So I would say within a mile probably for the radius of air disturbance.
And also as we talk about impact, I'm being reminded by one of our listeners in our chat room who asks, beyond the actual extraction process itself, what about the impacts of the so-called washing of the coal or coal ash itself? Is there any way to quantify a cumulative impact on human health population or human populational health?
I think the washing process is probably one of the most critical, personally, because it involves a variety of activities. It involves crushing coal, transporting coal, and that can create localized air disturbances, and it also contaminates a large quantity of water, both with the impurities present in the coal itself, as well as with the chemicals used in the cleaning process. These impurities, as we know, are then treated in some way. They're held in slurry impoundment ponds, or they're injected underground, where interface with water sources can also occur.
So if
cumulative impact, it's just very difficult to separate out one activity A from B from C because they're so closely interrelated. But that remains an important piece of work that needs to be done.
So in essence, if you are, for instance, like me, living near active or formerly active mountaintop removal sites, you've got kids, you've got grandkids, schools near these sites, is there anything that an individual can do to try to protect themselves against these impacts?
Try to treat your water system if you're on a private well. Put in filters that will handle metals. Boiling water is not sufficient for something like this. Change the air filters in your home as often as you need to. Change the water filters for your water supply. If you can, consider moving away.
That's scary. Dr. Hendricks, thank you very much. And let me ask generally of the panel, there is a sentence in the report that sort of jumped off the page at me toward the very end of the report. It's a small sentence, and it simply says, regulators should no longer ignore rigorous science. Implicit in that statement is, at least as I read it, the allegation that rigorous science has been heretofore ignored. Is that the case? Is that your assertion with the report?
I might comment on that. This is Dennis Lindley. In the instance of one mine in particular, the Environmental Protection Agency has had aquatic life criteria for selenium for many years. And, of course, that is a threshold beyond which some enforcement regulations or enforcement actions should take place. In the case of the Hobbit mine, during the period 2005 to 2007, that one mine complex was in violation of water quality criteria 600 times, and yet no enforcement action or regulatory enforcement was imposed by EPA or the state. So that in itself is just one example of how regulatory controls have failed in terms of policy and enforcement.
And as you note, that's one mine. And I recently sat in on an appeal board hearing down in Charleston, where I heard counsel for the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection state on the record to the court, if we shut down every mountaintop removal site because of water quality violations, we wouldn't be able, we'd have to shut them all down. At this point, it seems to me, if I read you all correctly, you're saying that there is no way that any regulatory scheme can come up with sufficient safeguards to prevent the sort of things that you've identified from happening. Is that correct?
Yes, I think you got it exactly correct. There's no evidence that water quality can be protected with current mining practices.
And Bob, we are actually at a point where we're about to lose our battery power here.
Well, I was going to close off with you, Doctor, and thank you in advance for the time that you've taken. And I've already talked to your assistant, Dr. Palmer. I'll be providing a copy of this recording. The recorded version of this to her for y'all's use.
I would like to make one last comment, and that is that it's important for the listeners to know that we have responded to every single inquiry for an interview.
Wonderful. That is inspiring, because it tells me that you understand the gravity of this situation. One last question. Where do you go from here? Is this a beginning point, or is this fully self-contained and the work is over?
I don't think the work is over. I think we're going to see a lot more on this. I think the important point we want to make is that this is basic science we're doing, and that the authors that are involved have no vested interest one way or another in the outcome of this. We're simply looking at the science and trying to provide the information that we hope will inform policies. This administration has been very clear that they want science to inform policy, and that's what we're trying to provide.
Well, I thank you very much, and I have a great admiration for real science, which this represents. And I know you've got to catch planes and so forth, and I wish you safe travels in miserable weather. And the very best, and thank you all for the time you've taken both this evening and in putting this study together. I hope it will be put to good use. I sincerely do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and good evening. And you have just heard from Dr. Margaret Palmer, Dr. Michael Hendricks, Dr. Emily Bernhardt, and Dr. A.D. Lemley, co-authors of the new study published in Science magazine, Mountaintop Mining Consequences, peer-reviewed, thorough, honest science. And I have to say that while the conversation was done in very factual form, it is freighted with the horror of what has been done to this region, to this state, to families, to communities. And if there is any morality whatsoever to be had among West Virginia's elected political representatives, this cannot be ignored. This simply cannot be ignored. It is 22 minutes before, 21 minutes before the hour, and we will go to the phones. If you wanted to discuss this issue, I invite you to jump right in. You know the toll-free number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your own nickel. It's 304-658-3333. Jump right in. We've got a couple of blinking lights. Let's go to them. Hey, welcome to the program.
Was my light blinking?
You were blinking.
Ooh. How exciting. Good interview. Ooh, I didn't know that was going to happen. It just took me right back to, it's kind of bad here where I live, too, because our well water, we have the arsenic comes back within little bitty fine print within acceptable limits, except it's way parts per million high. And I live really close to, agriculture land, and the well water, they're only testing one well when we get the report. So the seepage from fertilizers and nitrates and all, you know, all that stuff, I just think that our well waters, our ground, the groundwater is just in bad shape. And the feedlots, massive amounts of beef on hoof around here, and some mornings the smell is so bad that can't hardly stand it. And driving to town through the feedlots is just been almost it's awful. But what I it haunts me. I read somewhere that if you can smell if you can smell the air, you're inhaling whatever,
you're breathing whatever you're smelling.
Yeah. And so in the parts, but the stronger the smell, the higher the parts per million. And sometimes, and I think about the people who live down there by the feedlots. They're all brown people, of course. And they're raising the ammonia, the driving through there just sometimes burns my eyes. And I'm thinking about the children who live there. I mean, I'm only talking like 10 miles down the road. And we get it out here, too. And it's just so, and we get the brown cloud in Phoenix, get the air warnings, you know, stay inside if you've got respiratory, keep the babies inside. It's a, you know, whatever they call it, the ozone level or something. You know, I mean, we get those air warnings frequently here. And I look out and look north toward Phoenix, and it's just, it looks like living in Denver or L.A. It's just awful.
Well, the sad thing, Kate, is that this is, you know, these are issues that were discussed in the previous conversation that are central to Appalachia. But you can extrapolate out over the country what happens to the American people when you have people in office, such as we had during the 8 years between 2001 and 2009, who simply believe that taking care of the people is somehow evil and bad for business.
Yeah, yeah. I just don't understand it. It's beyond my comprehension. I just, oh, you talked about the morality. I heard you say something about the morality, and I thought, they got no morals. This is unregulated capitalism, and this is profit. We used to smell the paper mill in Tacoma, and people would go, oh, that's money. Okay? Makes me sick to my stomach, and I puke. And so, you know, that's about it.
I reckon you're allergic to money then, Kate.
Money that I am. Yeah, I don't have any.
Yeah, I know. I've been trying to do something about my allergy for years, and it just ain't no cure.
Okay. That brings me around. You got blinking lights, and so I wanted to get right to it. Two things. I'm calling to talk to the newcomers in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I listened to some of the archives this week, and I could get them until Verizon dumps me, and I think, oh, screw it, I'm going to bed. I can't deal with this anymore. If anybody is new listening and you're hearing the Wednesday night preacher, not that opening thing from that praise God, open up your, you know, that guy singing, not him.
No, because he sings real pretty.
You say, I mute it. The rant that Bob does at the beginning of the Wednesday night show, prayer meeting, you need to explain again to the audience in a minute what prayer meeting Wednesday is, and why.
Thanks for keeping me straight, Kate.
I'm calling as the cultural liaison, okay?
Okay, okay, okay.
Who do not understand why are we having this thing on Wednesday night prayer meeting? What does that mean? If anybody thinks that shtick that Bob does at the beginning of prayer meeting is just phony, he's just, no, that person is real. That person is real. He is everywhere down south. He is everywhere.
On every corner.
He is just as disgusting as Bob depicts him.
Yeah, see, you were scaring me for a minute there, Kate, when you said he's real. I guess, but then again, I guess a little bit of him does live down inside of me. It was burned into me sitting in the pews of the Southern Baptist Church.
That's what I'm saying. Well, yeah, I mean, the character that you're portraying at the beginning of prayer meeting is a real person. It's a real, that is not that person, those preachers are, that's not, it's not even exaggerated, okay? So I'm just talking to the new people who don't understand Southern preachers. And they're everywhere, and they're all scary, and they're all just as evil and ugly as that character that Bob does at the beginning of the show. So if you all think that was just, he's just putting on a big, he's just being a big drama queen, that, no, no, this is a real deal. And so, and the other thing, and you live, I guess, I don't know what show it was, what it was last night, maybe sometime in the, maybe the first 1.5 hours or something, you were talking football and sports with a caller, and you guys went on, and I thought pretty soon you were going to apologize to the listeners about sports, but you didn't, because then Verizon hung up on me, and I thought, okay, good night. Anyway, you let a line go by. You said, like, we need some relief, we need some relief, like Jerry Carr, we need some relief. And I'm thinking there's people out there going, Jerry, is he, who's he coaching for? You let the line go right. I mean, well, why would you interrupt yourself? You were on a roll, but it was so wonderful. So you might want to explain.
Yeah, there may be some cultural, there may be some cultural research needed on the late, great Jerry Clower.
Well, yeah, I mean, I know people who are related to him, and he, they say he was a wonderful man, and well, okay. Yeah, anyway, as the culturally.
Knock him out, John. That's the one I remember. You know, the guy up the tree with the wildcat, and knock him out. Shoot, John, shoot, but I might hit you. I don't care. Somebody up here got to get some relief. And there's much of that that's just the story of my life. Somebody got to get some relief.
I know. Stuff falls out of my mouth, and people look at me like, what? I don't understand what you're saying. What does that mean? You know, and I just thought I would just a cultural liaison night. I thought, when I heard that, I thought, right, out of context, I thought, there's somebody out there who's thinking, Jerry, who? Is he the coach? Is he the new coach?
Yeah, he's the new guy at Texas Tech.
We need some relief. We need some relief. Oh, God. Anyway, well, I called mostly to say that I'm leaving Arizona, and I'm going to be pulling out about 7 tonight.
You are Kate on the road once again.
Once again, yeah. Here we go again.
Just heading east on I-10, aren't you?
10. Yeah, 10. I take 8 till I hit 10, and then I take 10 until I hit Mississippi. I'm going to drop off into Texas City to check out the progress they're making in Galveston and Texas City, but I need to get back. A friend called me, and I need to be there pretty quick, and so it's not an emergency. But
this adventure may even pull you even further east, may it not?
It might. I'm a little apprehensive about that because this is all cold call, and I'm feeling like I'm fear and rejection. Like, no, we don't want volunteers. You have to be part of the meeting, you know, so for the health care thing, for the health clinics. And so I don't know, but I was told a few minutes ago by my goddess of clarification next door, my elder, she said, it's not February, and I think you need to go to Mississippi first. That's the first thing on your agenda, so just go to Mississippi. Oh, okay.
Well, that's all cleared up now.
It is. She always just kicks my ass.
Well, I trust you will have some sort of access there. Verizon may actually be able to hear you there, right?
Well, I'm going back to my friend's house for a bit for, you know, like two weeks or something, and that's where I didn't have very good cell phone. I had to go up the road toward the little cigarette corner grocery store to get a cell phone connection that didn't drop. So it's a little dead pocket down there on the bayou, and she just doesn't have very good Verizon tower. You know, it's
yeah,
okay,
but you're going to get some, Verizon tower may not be much good, but you're going to get some good eats.
You're going
back to a place where there's Crystal hot sauce on the shelf.
I have had Crystal on my shelf. I carry it with me. I pack my.
No, see, I can't get anything. I got Frank's. I got original Tabasco available to me, and I got Texas Pete. And I just as soon not use anything as use Texas Pete.
Mm-mm.
But I tell you what, I've become downright fond of another brand. Oh dear, food porn section. You've done it.
Yep.
This is the unpaid. This is the unpaid product endorsement of the evening. Cholula from Mexico. Cholula chili lime.
Yeah.
Hot sauce. I can drink that stuff straight out of a bottle.
I know. You told me about that.
Woo!
And anything with chili and chocolate in it, too, would be good on vanilla ice cream.
Shoot.
I carry a bottle of Crystal with me all times. It's in my little larder box. I have a little Rubbermaid box that has all my skillet and all my stuff in it, and that's where my Crystal is, and my brown rice.
Yeah, see the hoity-toity types. They say, you know, I'm getting some Cristal, and they're talking about some sort of champagne.
Mm-hmm.
No, they don't even know.
I don't even know.
We got better. We got Cristal hot sauce.
Yeah, it's so good on vanilla ice cream. So anyway, I just called to say that I'm heading out, and I'm going to be in a place where my computer works most of the time, but my cell phone reception and sometimes my I would be calling in as frequently as possible or infrequently as necessary. what else? I'm probably only going to be in Mississippi for about 2 weeks, and I'm going to head over to New Orleans and visit with friends over there. Okay, I have a question about the project that I'm feeling like is out there, but I don't quite know what it is, but I'm having this knowing that I need to go back and listen to stories.
Okie doke.
Just talk to people and let them tell their story, because
yep.
They're fixing to die, and they're in substandard housing, and it ain't never going to get no better.
And nobody is collecting the stories.
Nobody's asking what happened to you. Nobody asks how are you now. Just, did you get your road home money? No, we're still waiting. And the grandmas, I mean, some people just don't have much time left, and they haven't told their stories. They're dying with their song unsung. And I'm just feeling like I need to, I don't know what this is all about, but more than one person has said, you need to go, whatever. So my question is, I need an IT consult. What is a digital recorder? Why is it different? What does it do?
It's well worth having. It's how you record audio now that little cassette tapes and reel to reels and 8-tracks have gone the way of all flesh down there with the dinosaurs now.
Okay.
You can transfer it onto your computer. You can edit it digitally, and they're incredibly handy. Just make sure you get one with a USB interface so you can or that your computer will. You've got a card reader or some such, so you can transfer it to your computer and deal with it.
So after I've done an interview, then I can just take it, like, with my digital camera and dump it into the computer into a file?
Yes.
And then what do I do with it?
You can edit it. You can compress it. You can do most anything in the world you want to do with it.
You have to edit the audio, right?
Right. I mean, I assume if you want to, you know, take clips or something like that, yeah, you'd edit it out and create separate smaller soundbite files, things like that.
God, I only work with words.
That's okay, Kate. We'll get you through it. Just stay off the ledge. It'll be all right.
Okay. Isn't there something that
Zoom and in terms of brands, both Zoom and Sony make an excellent one. So does M Audio. Just write me and I'll send you a link to a few really, really good ones that, you know, they're not cripplingly expensive, but it's one of those instances where you get what you pay for.
Okay. Well, I just feel like I need to go over there and help somebody sing their song, you know, be there to somebody to sing their song and before they walk through the veil.
Well, just shoot me a note and I'll point you in the right direction.
All right. That brings me around to the end of this call. The money that I would use on the digital recorder would probably be what I would send in for fundraising for this month, not next month, but this month. And I just want to remind people one more time, you know how shaky it's getting out here, and you know how bad it is on the horn, and you know how close they came last month, but not close enough. And if we don't keep the money coming to the horn, to the mailbox or to the PayPal, we're going to lose this.
Horn go away.
Going to go down in the storm. The horn just went flat. So please, please, if you have any, just, it doesn't matter, $5, $2.50, $10, it doesn't matter, just send some money to keep the horn on the air, because we're going to lose we're going to lose it. It's going to go down. It's going to go under. So I know now's a rough time, and I, you know, excuses, but I first need to get to Mississippi and get that digital recorder, and then I can put my money back into PayPal, whatever. So just if you're looking for my donation, that's where it's at. It's going to Mississippi.
Well, that's it. And you know what? I would rather it went to Mississippi at this point.
Well, the truck's running good. Everything's repaired and everything. I got a clean bill of health on it, and my service manager keeps me on the road, and he goes bumper to bumper and says it's good to go, and when you get back, we'll put this on it and do that, and, you know, 6,000 miles and, you know, whatever. So I'm trouble-free so far, and I just want to let you know that I just want to let the listeners know, especially the new people, if you just think we're just sliding along and this is a really cool deal and it must be free, it's on the Internet. Wrong. You might want to explain what some of the expenses are and what they are and how close we are to not getting them met this month, and explain to the new people what prayer meeting is about, okay?
Okay, I can do that. Oh. I'll make a list. Okay. I've got a list here.
Okay.
You drive so, careful, Kate.
I do. Of course I do. And so I'll be in touch with on email. And so y'all take care out there and give the redhead a hug, and I'll... thanks for taking my call.
I wait all night for calls like these.
I know you do. Later, hon. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye now. That's Kate heading out on the road again, and we'll keep things rolling. Nope. Okay. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello.
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 Hi, who have I got?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yucatan Sunshine Habanero Sauce.
Oh, hey, love that stuff, too.
This is Bo.
Oh, hey, Bo. What's up, man?
Well, I'm just really grateful for Dr. Hendricks and his colleagues' work. And it's just good to hear what we already knew.
Yeah.
Just good to hear from the scientific community.
And well, it's good to hear it expressed in the language of science.
Yeah, and I just wonder, where do we go from here? What, you know, what is our governor going to have to say about this?
Well, and that's along the same lines as the question I asked Bo. And everybody, this is Bo from down the Coal River Valley, a dear friend of many years now, and someone who deals with mountaintop removal on a daily, if not hourly, basis. The question at this point, Bo, it becomes a question of morals and conscience. If you have morals and you have a conscience, you can't ignore this science.
I totally agree. You know, I heard Dr. Hendricks speaking about what's in the blasting dust.
Yeah.
And that's been a question I've had for years, and I've asked the West Virginia DEP that for many years, and they just look at me with stupefied faces. And you know, on my deck, we collect dust. We wipe it down, and there's glass in it. So I know the silica. But it's good to hear Dr. Hendricks talk about that whatever's in the ground that's being blasted out is what we're breathing, those of us that live beneath these sites. And I can't help but think about the kids at Marsh Fork Elementary who are also living on the other side of the ridge from me, who are living beneath blasting. And not only are they living beneath the blasting, they're living right next, they're going to school right next to this preparation plant. And if this governor continues to ignore Marsh Fork Elementary School and those children, then he's about as low as a human being can get. That's about...
It's an inescapable conclusion, Bo. And it's not something that we say flippantly, but you're absolutely correct. You know, what we're talking about here is, and you know, that phrase was used in the conversation on a number of different levels in a number of different contexts, cumulative effects.
Right.
This is stuff that builds up in a system over time. And, you know, to say, well, you know, the kids look healthy enough right now, is not only, it's not only short-sighted and ignorant, it's hateful, isn't it, Bo? It's just hateful because you can't, because with what these kids are being subjected to at Marsh Fork Elementary, you can't begin to calculate what it's going to mean in their lives 25 or 30 or 40 years down the road,
or
when they've
even
got...
Even 10. It's neglectable is what it is. And I believe that this science peer review is going to be out there now. If the governor continues to allow those kids to go to that school, and doesn't build them a new school, and allows coalfield communities to continue breathing this dust that we're breathing, he should be prosecuted. Someone should do something somewhere. I don't get federal government, Justice Department, someone. It's beyond ridiculous. It's total disrespect for human life.
Bo, isn't there some talk of the idea that Joe Manchin, Governor Manchin, is going to get a long sought face to face with President Obama somewhere around the 12th of this month? Did I read that correctly?
I read that. I don't know how true that is. I did read that.
Wouldn't you love? I guess this is a little bit of fantasizing, perhaps. But wouldn't you love to, if that happened? Wouldn't you love to have done the work that made it possible for President Obama just to take this study and hand it before Joe can get how are you out of his mouth? Just hand it to him and say, what do you think?
Yeah. Well, this puts President Obama in the light also, because he has said that we will go by science. Well, here it is. And, you know, it's nothing that hasn't been said before. You know, there was also an EPA environmental impact study on mountaintop removal quite a few years ago that said some of the same things that Dr. Hendricks and his colleagues are saying.
Right, but the Bush administration buried it in 2003.
Right. So what's our president going to do? What's he going to do? It's in his power to stop this. There's no doubt. It's in the EPA's power to stop this. When you consider the fact that people are at danger, you can stop this. And that's the part that they continually run away from addressing. They don't want to address it. They don't talk about the impact that it has on local communities and citizens and real people. They talk about mayflies, you know, and I totally understand the mayflies and the aquatic damage that's being done.
Yeah, because if they go, we're next.
Absolutely.
And it's not even so much that we're next.
Not only are we next, Bob, but we are going.
We're going
as we're talking here.
Right. We're going. We are contemporaneous with the mayflies. It's not a choice between mayflies and mining. It's a choice between mining and human life in this region.
Absolutely. And I think Dr. Hendricks' work proves that out. That the death rates in coalfield communities are much higher than other communities. And you know, our governor just needs—I don't know what he needs—but my suggestion to him is stop being a puppet, a lapdog for the coal industry, and try to become the leader that you won. At one time, you must have aspired to be, and be a leader. I don't know where we go from here. But, you know, I expect that the coal industry is going to come out with a bunch of. First they will ignore it, and then they will
ridicule it.
Yeah, that's what they'll do.
Well, they'll probably have somebody come out with some junk science.
Yeah, the same way
that ExxonMobil. Pays right. Scientists to say that the oil is, fossil fuels are not contributing to global warming, and that, in fact, oil is so good and good for you, you should be eating it on your breakfast cereal. The way that they pay those people, you know, the masses of the world, Don Blankenship, he's got somebody in his Rolodex that he can write the $250,000 check to, who will come out and say that, selenium's good. There's no evidence, because we've seen it, haven't we? Yeah. I mean, my God, an actual elected member of the Congress stood on the floor of the House not too many months back and said, CO2's natural, therefore it must be good for us.
Yeah, who said that?
That was Michelle Bachmann.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe it was Inman, but yeah. That figures.
Yeah, and you know, you're up against some real world-class ignorance when you're dealing with that. So, you know,
I'm not so sure it's ignorance anymore.
Well, some of it's bought and paid for.
Oh, yeah, I think that's what it is. Some people are just bought and paid for. That's the way they are. They have no scruples. They have no shame.
But they do have money.
And they have money.
That's so I guess, you know, I guess it falls to us. I'm already seeing, and as I'm sure you are on your email, there are calls going out to send this study far and wide.
Oh, yeah.
And to try to get people aware of what's going on. That's why I, you know, sort of stopped everything in its tracks to see if I could get Dr. Palmer and her colleagues on the program this evening.
Oh, it was great work.
This has to be.
So glad they were on there.
Oh, I am too. This just has to be. It has to be taken far and wide. This has to be disseminated to the point that it becomes ubiquitous. People can't be allowed to hide from it anymore. And that's not just, you know, that's not just around the country. It's in West Virginia too. And frankly,
I think we're going to see a snowball effect from this. I think we're going to see it all over the internet. I see the Washington Post. They've got it up.
It's up on the New York Times.
Yeah, it's up, and it's what we have to do is don't let this story die. It's there, and we need to force government to address the issue. And they need to stop it tomorrow. They need to stop it last week, but it needs to be stopped immediately. And you know, I say not only stop the permits, the application permits, but stop all of it right now.
Yeah,
people are being harmed.
And the thing I think one of the things that's so important out of this, Bo, is that this finally puts an end once and for all. And you and I have had numerous conversations on this. This puts an end once and for all to the "what about my job" argument.
I don't care about your job. You know, when it comes down to life and death. And people in harm's way. Some of these guys that are working on these strip sites, that are working on these mountaintop removal sites, need to stop and think, I'm killing my own child to get a paycheck. And, you know, that's a sad state of affairs in a free country and a superpower, the United States of America, that some people will allow themselves to be lowered to the point to damage their own children's health in order to receive a paycheck. And they need to think about that. And they need to stand up with us. Instead of intimidating and threatening to kill us, get next to us and let's go march on Charleston. Let's go march on Governor Manchin's house and let's demand new jobs.
A new economy. A real economy. Not a mono economy.
West Virginia has sacrificed for the United States of America to become the superpower just to this day. For over 100 years, it's time for federal government to show some gratitude and bring in new jobs to West Virginia with well-financed training.
Right, and you know what? We'll continue to supply energy for the nation's needs, but we can do it through wind. We can do it through solar.
The mix is a lot of things are in the mix. You know, including coal in the short term. Yeah, we do need to understand it, but it doesn't have to be mountaintop removal coal.
No.
And what we need to understand in this state, we need to understand the inevitable fact that coal is a declining industry and that natural gas is going to just wipe it out quickly.
Bo, why is it that people here in our state, and frankly outside West Virginia as well, why is it that they don't understand that that the coal companies themselves are not benevolent and protective societies? Why we've seen boom and bust 30, 50 times in this state.
Yeah.
What makes people think
cycle now? And you know what? There's not going to be another boom cycle of coal. And that's the other thing that our governor needs to understand. There are no more boom cycles. This is a bust cycle. It's going to remain a bust cycle. And we need to start doing the hard work to bring in new jobs. And these guys working on these mountaintop removal sites, I understand they need a job.
But you know what, Bo? These guys on those sites can have a job. If West Virginia got a tenth of what Wall Street got, we could keep every one of these guys on dozers working for the rest of their natural lives and their kids' work lives as well, trying to put what's already been done back to some semblance of right.
I would venture to say that Southern West Virginia produces more wealth than any other area of the country of its size, certain square miles, that yet we remain the poorest
And the closer you get to the mining itself, the poorer it gets.
Absolutely. Yeah, the closer you live to what they're doing, the poorer you are.
You know, anybody who ever, you know, by this program, a lot of folks have become familiar with things that are familiar to you and me, and folks have become familiar with, you know, places like Whitesville, and they know what's happened there. They know that a town was basically killed for coal, and they know what's waiting for the residents of the Coal River Valley behind the Brushy Fork impoundment. We can't quit. And so much work has gone into all of this, Bo. I guess, you know, we've done the political stuff. We've done the civil disobedience stuff. We've done everything in our power to get attention to people. I guess the next step is that we keep this study in people's faces and don't let them ignore
it.
This couldn't have happened.
We got the scientific community's attention, and, you know, now they are going to spread and carry this torch a little ways, and we're going to help them, and we're helping ourselves. We're going to continue spreading this. And what's happening is outrageous. And for it to continue to be allowed to happen is criminal. It's at the point of, if our president allows this to continue, then he's partaking in crime also. And, you know, that's a pretty harsh thing to say, but it's the truth.
It is.
And that's what we need to remember, is the truth. People like Roger Horton, who got on Diane Rehm's show today and went beyond stretching the truth. He actually began to lie. Joe Lovett made some very factual comments. And when Roger Horton got an opportunity to speak, he lied. And we need to expose these lies. And we just need to keep on with the truth, because the truth will bring things about. And the truth is going to give these guys on these mountaintop renewable sites a real job and a real future and a future for their children, because the lies are not going to do that.
No, they're not. And this couldn't have, you know, the other thing, the release of this study couldn't have come at a better time. I don't think there was anything deliberate in it, but, you know, this is the 7th of January, and here in 14 days, Bobby Kennedy will be dealing head-to-head with Don Blankenship in a public forum in Charleston, and Bobby will have this information at hand.
Yeah.
And frankly, unless he does what Horton did and just starts making stuff up, and of course, you know, Don Blankenship wouldn't do that. That's what Don Blankenship's going to have to do. He'll have to just start making stuff up, and it'll be jobs, 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 jobs. But like you said, that jobs argument doesn't wash in the face of science that says that this is killing people.
Well, also, you know, the other part too, Bob, it's not jobs. The coal industry is a declining industry. Our leaders need to, they know it, but it's about coal, 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 money in my pocket as a governor and as the coal industry. But the coal industry is a declining industry, and jobs are going to continue to decline in years ahead until there's none left. It's just that simple.
And you know, one of the things that came out of Dr. Hendricks's research, Bo, is the fact that we know now that for every dollar coal brings to West Virginia, it costs us five.
Absolutely, the economic burden that mountaintop removal is putting on the state is amazing. I'm gonna go ahead and let the cat out of the bag, I guess, so to speak. There's a debate January 21st at the
University of Charleston.
And on January 25th, there's a meeting that is supposed to take place with the governor, our federal representatives, and or their staff. The coal industry, Bill Arrhenius, is supposed to be there, and Randy Huffman is supposed to be there, and a team of folks that I've put together. And I asked for the meeting, and I worked on it for the last couple, 3 months, and was granted the meeting. I received day before yesterday an email from the governor's senior staff and with the governor's format for this meeting. And basically the format was just, it was set up the best I could derive from the email and the set up format agenda, was, you know, for the governor to, and the coal industry to, and those that support the coal industry to basically give us a lecture. And so this morning I emailed the governor's senior staff, Travis Mollihan, and told him that that was unacceptable and proposed our format and basically just told them that, you know, the coal industry has had the governor's ear. It's time for the governor to.
Well, if he can't simply meet with affected community members,
absolutely,
without having Bill Rainey or Don Blankenship or somebody holding his hand, that speaks volumes about his personal weakness.
Well, you know, I don't mind Bill Rainey being there because there's some things that Bill Rainey needs to hear, and I don't mind that a bit. But there's some of the members of our delegation are well known, and they're biologists, and they've done a lot of work in this field also. And we're going to see where this goes. But if I don't see how the governor cannot give us 40 minutes of his ear, and that's really basically all we're asking for out of an hour and a half meeting. We're asking for about 40 minutes of where we can get prepared.
Out of 90 minutes, you don't get 40?
Well,
in their format?
Their proposed format, the way it was set up, would be very, very, very minimal participation from our part. He spoke of a roundtable discussion. Well, you know, the roundtable discussion involves the coal industry and our delegates in this state that support the coal industry. And that's not what we are, that's not why I asked the meeting for. I asked the meeting for the governor to listen to our concerns, because we're concerned about the future of West Virginia. And we know that mountaintop removal is detrimental to the future of West Virginia. And therefore, we want his ear. We have some suggestions about the economy and jobs. And he needs to listen. And he needs to come to the understanding that mountaintop removal is basically over. It's going to be over. I think Senator Byrd said it very well, that we either adapt or be left behind. And that's our concern, is that we need to start making those changes to make West Virginia sustainable and a future for all of our children. And, you know, and economic prosperity, and realizing that coal is not the future of West Virginia, and especially mountaintop removal is not.
And you know, this all comes on the heels of the ballyhoo over the agreement being reached about Hobet 45, which is, you know, a monstrous, humongous complex in Lincoln County that will have downstream and downtime effects possibly beyond the scope of our comprehension. This makes all of that irrelevant.
Yeah. You know, they said that the Hobet engineers, the mining plan is going to reduce the environmental impact by 50%. Basically, I don't know if I'm saying it correctly, but I think that's what they said. And I'm just thinking, well, if that's the case, then how much of an environmental impact should we have been saving for the past 15 years? 20 years, whatever it might be.
Yeah, if they're capable of doing it, why haven't they been doing it?
Right.
And, of course, you know, the next question that follows that is, okay, you're reducing it by 50%. What about the 50% of degradation and harm to communities, families, and people that results from it? You know, what is the meaning, what is the quantifiable meaning of 50% less cancer? It's still cancer.
Well, I think the bottom line is that they will reduce it as much as they can until it becomes economically unfeasible to do it. When they no longer make a profit, when they are not making the profit that they can make in another state, in another location, they'll do that. When that time comes, they're gone.
But you know, Bo, one of the things that perhaps we overlook, and I just happened to read this earlier today, is the fact that there's so much riding on us stopping this here, because other portions of the world are set to adopt the mountaintop removal model even as we speak.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, if they leave here, they'll go to South America. They'll go to Colombia. They're already doing it.
Yeah, sure.
You know? So, you know, we have to really set the, get the truth out from here. And I think that's what is so great about the report that came out today.
It gets it, you know, the facts are in their faces and they can't get away from it anymore. Bo, I tell you what, I really appreciate you calling in on this, and I'm glad that you shared your thoughts with the folks listening to the Horn, and who will hear this in podcast. It's a pleasure working with you, and I'm looking forward to the next opportunity to do so. I guess there's big doings coming up at the end of January as well, up in D.C. Lobby Week is coming up in March. All we can do is keep the heat on and be absolutely.
Absolutely, and that's what we're doing. And your show, Bob, is a huge part of this movement and a huge part of getting the word out. And it is a bona fide movement. And unlike the 60s and the war, it's unlike that. This is a movement that it just keeps growing, and it's got wheels. And when people find out about mountaintop removal, they're revolted, they're repulsed by it. And so we're exposing the truth, and we're going to continue to do that. And thank you for all that you're doing.
Well, I'll be talking to you soon. You take care, my friend. All right.
All right.
Bye now.
Bye bye.
That's our buddy Bo Webb. A special individual. It's beyond expression. It was Bo who first got me active in the movement way, way back in the bad old days of terrestrial radio in America's fifth smallest radio market, Beckley, West Virginia, when the rest of when the right wing host simply hung up when anyone tried to talk about mountaintop removal. We started the conversation in the earliest days of Head On with Bob Kincaid, and it's just been stunning to see the growth of the movement, the awareness that has come about. And let me reiterate what I said a moment ago. There are people all over this planet who have the misfortune, whether they know it or not, to be living near or on top of coal. And if we, and if you, and our efforts all together do not succeed in ending this, then the ramifications around the globe are horrifying past horrifying. This thing, as a practice, must be stopped. You heard the numbers. 500 mountains, 1,200 miles of streams, dead, forever dead. What did Dr. Bernhardt say? Lost as far out as these streams are lost as far out as we are able to look. I believe Dr. Palmer at some point mentioned the fact that the forests will not return to these devastated moonscapes for something like, at best, at the earliest, 10,000 years. And I'm just enough of a weirdo that I think about things like these sludge impoundments, and they are pernicious enough in their potential doom in the present. But I also think about, I try to think, because being human, our scope is so foreshortened and so myopic because of our short years of individual lifespans. But if you try to imagine 500 years from now, or 1,000 years from now, or 10,000 years from now, if those sludge dams are still holding, and there's no reason to expect that they would be, but if they are, whatever life is here, if the technology and the civilization has at all been compromised, well, the first thing that dies with a civilization is its collective knowledge. And our knowledge is so fragile. You know, we know some things about the ancients, for instance, because they had a habit of carving things in stone. And thus we can read the dedicatory inscription to Marcus Agrippa on top of the Pantheon in Rome. And we can read various and sundry other things because they were carved in stone. We don't carve in stone anymore. The physical, what physicality this program has is merely a matter of collected bits and bytes of data housed on a server. How fragile is that? How fragile is a town's water supply, a city's water supply? Atlanta, Georgia, that draws its water from the Chattahoochee River, that you can wade across it and not get your knees wet in places. And millions depend on that for their drinking water. And it's drying up. The reservoirs, downstream reservoirs where they're finding selenium, as you heard in the conversation, that has real world effect, real world impact. And if our cultural civilization knowledge is compromised, then whoever is left that would happen to wander by one of those toxic waste sites is doomed. If the whole region by then hasn't been rendered a dead place when these things explode and burst, and there's no way to fix them, there's no way to attempt to clean them up. Oh, the ramifications are long and deep. But that's the first half of the program. Email rolling in from our buddy David in Tennessee. Wait for it, Bob. I bet you'll hear it. Some bought and paid for West Virginia state official will say, well, certainly not. I'm not letting some magazine article put hard working West Virginia miners out of a job. David says, hell, for all I know, one of them may have already said it for the public to hear. I wouldn't take that bet because he's probably right. And the job becomes one of telling people, of not letting them off the hook, not letting them ignore science. Science, the very essence. Science, coming from the Latin word scio, meaning knowledge, not hope, not belief, knowledge. And we can't let people ignore knowledge, ignore facts. Because they may choose to, while they may choose to ignore them, their ignorance has long-term effects on me, mine, you, and yours. And as the old saying goes, you do have a right to your own opinions, but you don't have a right to your own facts. Yeah, Tobias, you're right. Auschwitz guards had to have jobs too. And that's the kind of calculus that they're engaged in. Anything for a job, anything for a buck, because they have been the people working on these operations have been terrified into the corner that is their economic existence working in this poison. Whew. And all we can do is keep working, as so many of us do, and so many people who work so much harder than I could ever even dream of doing. It is an amazing thing to be close to. Here at the halfway point, we'll take a little break. On the way, the Green News Report from Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. And we'll come back to your calls if you want to, or Lord knows there's a big enough stack for just about anything we might want to do. You're welcome to chime in. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877 the numeral 4, head on. On your nickel, 304-658-3333. Email rolls in to Bob Kincaid Tobias@gmail.com. And yeah, Tobias, you're right. Fear is the drug, and they are dealing. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This only happens with your support. This is The Horn.
Them lonesome songs, I can tell by the way I feel that it comes from somewhere else. Got that sweet mountain soul down in my bones. I got that sweet mountain spirit down in my veins.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Thursday, January 7, 2010.
Whale wars turn violent. Obama administration gets serious. Senate retirements threaten climate legislation. Plus, is America's love affair with the automobile over?
All of that and more straight ahead. Stand by for 6 minutes of green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
For some reason, an ExxonMobil-funded phony think tank put out a press release claiming the CIA was now studying climate change instead of spies. Golly, I wonder why they did that.
Why would they do that? Energy companies hoping to use terrorism to distract from climate issues? That's a real head-scratcher, Keith. But this is your Green News Report. The Green News Report is brought to you by VelvetRevolution.us. It's now officially another big election year, and VR is continuing our years-long fight against failed and faulty electronic voting systems. Show your support before it's too late by signing on to VR's DeboldReturnOurMoney.com campaign. It's free, and your voice makes a difference. Sign up at DeboldReturnOurMoney.com to continue the fight for free, fair, accurate, and transparent elections in 2010. That's DeboldReturnOurMoney.com. Okay, the globe is warming, but the nation is freezing as a cold snap continues across much of the country. Today, Desi, what do you have rolling for us?
Well, clashes over Japan's whaling industry turned violent yesterday. A speedboat run by anti-whaling activist group Sea Shepherd was rammed yesterday in the Antarctic by a security vessel employed by a Japanese whaling ship. The activist's boat was severely damaged, but all crew members were rescued without serious injury by the Bob Barker. No, not the retired game show host, but an anti-whaling ship named after him. Sea Shepherd has been dogging Japan's whaling fleet in an attempt to end the annual hunt. A loophole in maritime law allows Japan to kill over 1,000 whales every year. The video of the clash is quite stunning. We have the links on our website, greennews.bradblog.com.
Most stunning was that Batman-like boat that the Japanese vessel ended up crushing and sinking. That boat alone is worth looking at the video for.
The Obama administration has started the new year with a bang. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar this week announced new federal drilling policies for oil and gas exploration in the West to protect wilderness areas. In a conference call, Salazar slammed the Bush administration Interior Department, calling them, quote, the handmaiden of industry and a candy store where oil and gas companies could, quote, take whatever they wanted.
Wow.
Also this week, the U.S. Bureau of Land Management announced it will fast-track the permitting process for 31 renewable energy development projects in the deserts of California
and
Nevada.
Good for them. Good for them.
Yes, to help those projects meet the deadline to qualify for stimulus funds from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. The BLM's move may help to ease the conflict between renewable energy projects and wilderness protection. Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California, recently proposed a measure to set aside large parcels of sensitive habitat in the Mojave Desert as national monuments, which would prevent all energy development in those areas. And the EPA announced new draft rules to limit smog pollution from power plants and other big industrial emitters that are far more strict than the standards established during the Bush administration. The draft rules will tighten standards for ozone pollution, which has long been associated with increasingly negative public health impacts like asthma and lung disease. The Bush-era rules were criticized by the EPA's own Science Advisory Committee at the time for being too lax to protect public health. Environmental group Clean Air Watch called the new move, quote, the most significant environmental step the Obama administration will take this year.
And they've taken quite a few significant steps, so I'm glad to see them upping the ante even further here.
None of us is irreplaceable. None of us are indispensable.
That was Senator Chris Dodd, Democrat of Connecticut, announcing his retirement yesterday, one of two Democrats in the Senate that have announced they will not seek re-election in 2010. The retirements jeopardize the Democrats' so-called 60-seat majority, such as it is, and may also jeopardize the passage of climate and clean energy legislation currently stalled in the Senate.
Although it should be pointed out that in Dodd's case, this may actually increase the chances of a Democrat holding on to that seat, since Dodd has been under a lot of fire. In North Dakota, however, with Dorgan, the story is quite different.
North Dakota is said to lean Republican,
which is going to be a further reason for the Republicans to continue stalling on this legislation, and more reason for the Democrats to keep moving it forward before the elections this November.
Finally, for the first time in our nation's history, the number of cars in the U.S. has dropped. Last year, consumers scrapped more cars than they bought. 4 million more cars were taken out of service last year than were purchased. That's down from a record high in 2007, but we should still note that we have 246 million cars. Analysts say the Great Recession reduced demand for new cars and also led cities to expand public transit options. But they also say the trend could indicate a permanent shift in American driving habits and consumption.
Mark my words, the love affair will return as soon as we get our electric car. Read about that and much more at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. Follow us on Twitter. Download us on iTunes. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyle.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Electric car on road so dark, to change the air, rewrite the start. Electric car, so good so far.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
While I get over the chills.
Whew.
Those last couple of songs you heard are both from a magnificent compilation album called Still Moving Mountains, The Journey Home, available from Aurora Lights. Just Google it, Aurora Lights. You want this. Yeah, you really want this. That song, a portion of which you heard by a friend, Andrew McKnight, the guy who, the author also and performer of another song that sends chills down my spine, Company Town, on the first Moving Mountains disc. And then going into the break, of course, the incomparable Del McCurry Band and Sweet Appalachia. That is also on Still Moving Mountains. And another thing that sort of sets the little hairs on the back of your neck up, I'm reminded via email by Ron in Raleigh of, because Tobias, before we went to the break, had sent me a message saying the coal companies know that fear is a drug, and they're dealing. And that is the absolute truth. You know, the fact of the matter is, the people who work on mountain removal jobs are motivated by little more than fear, because they are kept in a constant, just gut-bending state of fear. And believe you me, the company likes it that way. And so Ron in Raleigh sends this along, and it really does have mantra quality, doesn't it? He says, you know, Frank Herbert had a handle on fear in the Dune novels. Remember the litany, I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain. Says Ron, maybe we all should commit this to memory. Maybe we should. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death. But see, that's the one thing that the coal companies don't want their workers to know. That fear to a coal company boss, that fear smells like money. Yes, it does. And we will go now to the phones and see what's going on. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Juanita.
Well, that's the way the Bush administration rose too.
Sure.
Fear.
Yeah.
And you know, we're so ingrained in it, it's hard to remember what it was like before when it wasn't that bad. You know what I mean? It's kind of like you get into the groove of it. And, but I'm going to ask you, now, these people that are working on the mountaintop removal, the people who are or the dupes, actually, aren't they in risk of their health?
Yes.
Doing what they are doing?
They absolutely are. They're breathing this stuff.
They're
walking in the muck. They're taking, and that's what Bo was talking about. They're taking a paycheck in exchange for poisoning their own children.
Yeah. And they don't even know it.
Well, they
think they have to do it.
They do, but they don't. They know that they know in the dark and still of the night with the sweats on the sweat on their brow line that gets them sitting bolt upright in bed at 3 a.m. They know. But by 6 a.m. when they got to get off to work and they know that there's a paycheck at the end of the week, they can compartmentalize it and pretend it doesn't exist until the doctor tells them something horrifying about themselves or their wives or their kids.
Yeah, I thought he said something about that. I've been wondering about it, and I really thought about it today when I heard the conference show. I didn't hear all of that, but what I did hear and all, it just came to me that they're risking their health, too.
Yes, and occupational hazards, lung disease, pulmonary disease, heart disease, everything that stuff does to one degree or another downstream, it does 100 times over when you're in the middle of it. You know, I hear.
I would think so. Yeah, it's like Kate was talking about the air that we breathe. You know.
Yeah.
That any kind of a pollution that goes into it. You know, I used to didn't realize that if you had bad water and you're taking a shower, that bad water goes through your skin worse than it does when you drink it.
You're darn right.
It does worse, treats you worse than when you're drinking it.
And how do you get away from it?
I know.
I mean, and you know, you've seen the stories about public water drinking water supplies, you know, so-called city water. That's what we call it around here.
Yeah, that's what I have now.
And that stuff's full of, you know, remember that study that said it was full of, there were traces of antidepressants and tranquilizers and various and sundry poisons in all of it.
Feces.
Yeah.
And, well, you know, I said before that when Jeb first became our governor, he was talking about converting the septic sewage into clean drinking water. And then he kind of backed down on it, but I'm wondering if he didn't do it. You know, there's people down here that have bad water. I mean, mine, I guess, is as good as you can get, you know, without being obvious. But there's some other places that their water is just obviously terrible. I don't even know how they get by. I really don't.
Well, consider, for instance, the folks out at Black Mesa in Arizona. Now, it's Arizona.
Oh, yeah.
There's not just a lot of water. And you've got people living on the res out there, the Hopi and Navajo reservations who don't have indoor plumbing, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
And then what little water they do have, is being taken from them by Peabody Coal that has drilled down, you know, God, 3,000 feet maybe, I'm not sure what. Into the only aquifer that's there, and they're pumping that water out and sending it to California in the form of coal slurry.
Oh, boy.
And you just sit there with your head aching and your little temples throbbing, going, how can this possibly be legal?
Right. Absolutely. And it's like Bo said, you know, money. It's all about money.
I guess money is profound and money is strong because it can drown out a conscience.
Yeah. And also money's power.
Without a doubt. And I guess that power conveys the ability to ignore one's morals, ignore one's conscience, take the money, and just do whatever evil is required in order to satisfy the shareholders.
Yeah. Oh. Well, are they satisfying the shareholders or is that just satisfying their self?
Well, that's the thing. You know, when you're one of those CEO types, you've got a big old portfolio of deferred stock options. So every time you do something that causes the stock to go up a quarter of a penny, you've done something for yourself.
Well, it just makes you...
Kind of makes you want to scream, doesn't it, Juanita?
They live with their self, huh?
It kind of makes you want to scream, doesn't it?
Yeah, oh, yeah. And, you know, you wonder how people can live with themselves. They obviously don't have any compassion.
Well, no, wait a minute, Juanita. They have compassion. But they, for themselves and those that they deem to be worthy of the compassion.
Right. Just like the family.
Yeah, we are. But you see, we out there, you know, in that other world they imagine, we are not worthy of their compassion.
Right.
We are not even worthy of their notice.
There you go.
You know, if we die, they don't know and they don't care.
Right.
And the only way that they do find out is if somebody manages to file a lawsuit to hold them to account. You know, Don Blankenship from Massey darn sure didn't show up when they buried a 23-year-old young man who'd had his insides burned up with cancer from living on top of poison for his short life down in the Coal River Valley. There were no coal executives there saying, well, you know, he sacrificed for the greater good.
Yeah.
He was beneath their notice.
Right. Just like our troops beneath the notice of.
Yeah, you know, so what?
Served.
Yeah, 300 to 500 will die every month in Afghanistan because of this stupid surge. You know, so what? They signed on the dotted line. They knew what they were getting into. Who cares? I care.
Yeah.
You care.
And they want to have more wars.
Oh,
they
shucks,
can't decide
yeah.
Just how many more they want.
I'm sure that somewhere sitting around at CENTCOM or BLABCOM or PACNAT or whatever it is, there's some general or some sort that's sitting there thinking, you know what, that Yemen looks like a fun place to drive a tank.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That didn't the leader of the world, Lieberman, say that would be the next? Possibly be the next?
He's
the leader of the world,
ain't he? He did indeed. Oh, yes, he is. He is Supreme Godhead Lieberman.
Yeah. Great Antichrist.
About the size of it. One of these days, they're going to come round us up.
I know.
You know that Juanita woman? Yeah, come with us.
No, I've thought about that a lot.
You know that Bob? Juanita, you know that Bob Kincaid?
Yeah.
Come with us.
We'll get to go to work, Guantanamo, and have those flights.
Yeah, well, we'll just carry on conversations between the bar, you know, across the barbed wire instead of the back fence then, Juanita.
Can I do a little Bible study with you?
You absolutely can.
You were talking about King Saul.
Yes.
And that's one section of the Bible I know more about. I've probably studied that before.
And to be fair, it doesn't say that David and Jonathan were out, romping.
The thing that I was, in fact, it's one of the funniest things. It's funny in ironic ways. First of all, Israel, you know, they were ruled by judges.
Right.
But, you know, it's kind of like a good free country. But they decided they wanted to be like the other countries. They wanted a king.
They wanted them a king, absolutely.
And they talked to Samuel about it, and Samuel was a prophet, and he talked to God. And
God said, you know, you really don't want this.
If you have a king, you're not going to be free anymore. You have to do what the king said. No, well, that's what we want. We know that. We want it.
Looky there, them Edomites, they got a king. Them Canaanites got a king. The Philistines, they got a king. We want a king, God. We want a king.
Yeah. And so they got their king. And Saul, you know, was very pleasing to God to begin with. You know, and he was a handsome, tall guy, you know, taller than anybody.
I'd forgotten that part, but you're right.
But he was, I don't know if he had migraines or what, but he depression or what it was, and when David came into his life, you know, David could help him by playing songs for him. But to make a story short, it ended up, I think a lot of what happened with Saul was he became jealous and then full of fear about David, talking about fear. And, you know, Saul would send David out to fight. And when David would come back, you know, then, like, for instance, here it says, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tabrets, with joy, and with instruments of music. And the women answered one another as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands, and David, he is 10,000. And Saul was very wroth, and the saying displeased him, and he said, they have ascribed unto David 10,000, and to me they have ascribed but thousands. And what can he have more but the kingdom, see? And Saul eyed David from that day and forward.
And the fact that him and Jonathan were buddies wasn't helping any.
No, I imagine not. But I just wanted to bring that up. I thought, you know, the Bible, I mean, like you said, it's funny.
It is.
When you really get into it, it can be funny in ironic ways.
Aren't sick and twisted, yeah. And you can even get a laugh out of that sometimes.
Well,
it's
human nature, you know.
Sometimes I have this mental image of Lot's wife getting turned into a pillar of salt and Lot standing there with his, you know, because we know what the daughters were going to do, and they're just standing there with their margarita glasses salting the rims on Lot's wife.
Yeah. It could be.
One of these days they're going to get me.
there's a couple of things I like about what Jesus, you know, this guy kept saying, Master, Master, make my brother share the inheritance with me. And Jesus said, Man, who made me a judge or divider over you?
Yeah, that, you know, that's it's not my job.
I don't know.
See, it all gets written up.
Looking at things.
It all gets written up so fancy-like, and there's not enough narrative in there to say, you know, and then loaded Jesus raise one eyebrow while keeping the other one down and give a withering glance unto the moron.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's what we need in there.
Peter. Poor old Peter was always screwing up.
Well, you know, that's the whole thing about the Lord. Who's good? Who gets to sit right next to you, Lord? I don't want to sit two seats down. I want to sit right next to you, Jesus, in heaven. You know, and do we get a crown? Who gets the crown? I want the crown, Jesus. Y'all get a crown.
The thing is, John and James's mother, she wanted them to be the number one. She got herself into that.
Exactly. And any close reading of that, you can sort of see the steam starting to come out of Jesus' ears. Y'all get a crown. Now, can we please deal with something that matters here?
Well.
Focus. Focus, morons. Focus.
I'll tell you, when I started reading all that stuff about Saul and David, and I always felt sorry for Saul.
Well, you know, there's a lot of them.
God, why? That's not fair.
There's a lot of them to feel sorry for, Juanita, because.
I guess, Judas?
You know, I'll never forget the Southern Baptist minister, the look I got from him the day that I looked at him and said, shouldn't we take it easy on Judas? I mean, after all this good stuff that we say, the sacrificing, dying for our sins and stuff, that don't happen without Judas. We owe Judas a little debt of gratitude, don't we, preacher? Sit down, son.
Yeah. That's right. You're right. But anyway.
But you can't do that kind of stuff because if it's not, you know, if it's, they don't go off script very well at all, fundamentalists, evangelicals.
Yeah. But anyway, I don't know if I had anything else to say or not, but let's say farewell for and Godspeed to Kate. She's on the road again.
Yeah, I guess here about, 2.5 hours from now, she's going to jump in the truck and head for I-10.
Yeah. Well.
That's a nice thing. It's all I-10 all the way to Mississippi, so it's not like she can get lost.
Good. She's going from Arizona?
She turns left, and then she turns left on 10, and then it's over. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just straight on through.
She'd have a good movie.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt, she would.
Yeah. Well, okay, well, listen, I guess I'll let you go because my mind went blank.
Happens to me all the time. Somehow I managed to get through the show just the same. Thank you, Juanita. You have a wonderful evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye now. You know, I think, I don't know, she used, like I said, she used to be our VIEW correspondent. I think Juanita may have to be our Bible consultant. Because I have a feeling that Juanita's probably forgot more Bible than most evangelicals will ever know. And that's a compliment. That is a compliment indeed. Let's see. Let's keep things rolling and see what's going on here. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Hey, Sandra, what's up?
I know you got all those emails from me.
Oh, you've been busy today.
I know. I don't know. I just am sort of, I'm sort of, in between these semesters, and I got obviously too much time because this shit is really starting to get to me.
How can it not?
Well, I just, you know, I guess I was sort of just completely at a loss, and I'm still at a loss with this sort of him, Obama, siding with this tax on the so-called Cadillac plan, which in itself is just BS, you know, because all those are negotiated trade-offs. They would have gotten wage increases instead, right?
You would, yes.
So it's not really, you know, so they're taxing, you know, what, you know what I mean? They're taxing a benefit that could have been translated into a wage, you see, and it's just, it's unbelievable. The idea that they can't bring themselves to taxing rich people in this country is like almost pathological at this point.
It's a little past, one, it makes your eyeballs roll back in your head, but I don't know. How can anybody think that this is a good idea?
Well, the whole idea that it's going to filter out into, that they're going to pass it on to the workers and increase wages is just like, I don't know, some sort of bad joke, right? It's an unbelievable statement from the CBO or any other entity that dares to say that is how it's going to play out. Because the way it's going to play out is they're going to pocket that difference and give the workers less health care.
And I guess, we swapped emails on this. Is the thinking behind this that it'll drive people to holler for a universal single payer system? Is that the sort of political kung fu going on here? Because I don't think that's going to work.
Well, no, it's just, like I said, either someone's in a real bubble, or they're just very cynical and don't give a F, and they don't care that we know that now. Because what this will do, because I've like read quite a bit, I even looked at, some of the actual bill, which, believe me, my eyes were burning out after that. But what it looks like is that it is a tax, and the idea is that it will drive people from getting excess care, whatever that is.
And frankly, I don't know what that is, because isn't this, some of these so-called Cadillac plans, doesn't what makes them Cadillac plans be, isn't it the fact that it covers things like vision and dental?
Well,
taking care of your eyeballs and your teeth is somehow a luxury now?
Well, yeah, and also what it does, because the copay and the out-of-pocket is less, you're inclined to go and get the checkup, go and get the colonoscopy, go and get the test, because you're not paying $700 a pop for it.
Right.
Like you would be if you got what we're all going to be subjected to real soon. You see what I mean? So in the end, you're still going to end up paying more, because when you're real sick, I don't think people are just going to drop dead in the street. They are going to make an effort to get a care. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's going to cost somebody something.
And the thing that's crazy, based on what you've just described, Sandra, what's crazy making out of this is there's a drumbeat inside the healthcare argument, and I've heard Obama make it, and the various and sundry other people, we're going to have a wellness plan, we're going to have preventative care. Well,
that
you just
cost.
But they just took the bite out of a whole bunch. That's what this tax is going to do.
Well, no, and that's the whole idea that taxing the premium as if it's punishing people for getting a better product, but they're not in control of the product because it goes up without our say. You know what I mean?
Right. And how is in any political calculus, how is this a good idea?
I don't know, because it's not like I can say, I'm going to pay, $12,000 for my premium because I want the absolute best top whatever, and I'll just pay the 40% because I still want that top. That's not what's going on. What's going on is that it's increasing double digits every year because everybody's rapacious, greedy MFers. And we're being taxed because we're forced to have to pay what they charge. It's just crazy. The whole thing is just, that's why I say I was spitting nails, because it really does not make sense. When you could charge a small tax on every person in this country, and it would be $4,000 a year, not $8,000. You know what I mean?
But the thing is, it's going to have middle class impacts. At which point, from a political standpoint, it's going to give more fodder to the weirdos.
Well, no, and that's the thing that you were saying. Yeah, is that this idea that we don't have to worry about the facts? I thought that was a good point. What these fools are thinking? Because down the road or something, which is just absolute madness.
But the thing is, the down the road part of it happens inside what Barack Obama, I assume, still hopes will be his second term.
Well, yeah, but know if they think, I don't, you know, that's what I'm saying. I'm not too sure what the calculus is. You know, I'm willing to listen to any argument because none of this makes sense, the sort of taxing. I mean,
you raise an issue right there, the separate and apart from the actual nuts and bolts of the bill, Sandra. Where in the world is the Democratic leadership in getting the argument out to the people? I mean, granted, you can't turn around without seeing some birther, bagger, deather, tenther, you know, screaming about they're going to take over my health care. It's a complete socialist government take over a health care, blah, blah, blah. Where's our side?
No, I mean...
Any of us?
No, it's incredible because, you know, as hard as I can, you know, I looked at this and tried to, you know, try to come up with any usefulness of this sort of tax on the actual product on top of, you know, without any controls anywhere else. It's just bizarre. That's what all I can say. It's really bizarre. It's mandated. It's taxed. It's incredible. And it doesn't kick in for years, but over 3 years, it goes from what we have now to some sort of horror show. Sorry.
Ugh.
You know. So, yeah, anyway, I just sort of...
Oh, I got it, but I got to ask you. We'll sort of go away from this for a minute, though, because, you know, we talk. You sort of keep us abreast of California doings. ELO in the chat room, otherwise known as Sue, sent me the link to the story about Schwarzenegger's, you know, the governor's last State of the State address, and she sent me this one particular quote, and it just made me want to scream and run around the room naked, where he said, "The budget crisis is our Katrina. We knew it was coming. We've known it for years. And yet Sacramento would not reinforce the economic levies." How tone deaf is this Austrian?
Oh, my Lord. No, you know, I recorded that, you know, on the DVR, whatever thing is we got here, because I wanted to look at it because I didn't get a chance to watch it. So he's just upset because a few court cases has come down that's tying his hands further about furloughs and all this business.
Yeah, he got whacked on the furloughs, didn't he?
Yeah, but they're trying to say now that he may have the option to just do mass layoffs.
Say,
so,
you can't furlough, but you can just lay off?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is sort of the argument that's coming out, but, I mean, even that is dubious. I mean, he basically, you know, there are some constraints in California because different offices are elected separately, you know what I mean?
Right.
So he has to, there's a lot of constraints on his power. But it's just a mess. It's a real mess here because I guess we're looking at another $20 billion plus.
Well, at what point in time do Californians sort of get out the pitchforks and the torches and do something about, what was it, Prop 13?
It's just people don't have they have no idea about political efficacy anymore, obviously, because they're just going to whack more and more and more until what? They destroy the public sector completely. I mean, I'm not too sure of the end game, but unfortunately, all Californians don't really know how to respond, you know?
Ultimately, there's been a little bit of a bait and switch over the last generation or so. The American people have been taught to think that an anarchist is a disaffected kid with a hoodie and a mask on his face turning over mailboxes. The anarchists are the people who brought California to the brink of economic ruin, because what you described is exactly what's going on. The end game is ultimately the complete dissolution of the functionality of government, which will result in the kind of anarchy that is not good. But, you know, California's on that road, isn't it?
Well, yeah, no, that's what I mean. I mean, I'm not, like, exaggerating, because the normal response to what's going on isn't firing at all. I mean, it's just sort of, we're having this cycle of, okay, well, we're 20, 30, 40 billion in the hole. We'll just slash, 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 and, privatize everything. And so what you have left is Meg, whoever, who may become governor, who is some sort of right-wing freak of the eBay fame. You know about her, right?
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, this is what we have to look forward to. So it's like, you know, dystopia. I mean, I don't know. I'm just sort of, I look at Arnold Schwarzenegger, and I just read an article where he might be in line to be the Secretary of Interior. Hello.
I would scream.
Yeah, so that's something out there, which I thought you might find.
No, I will run around the room naked if that happens. That's just nuts.
Right. Well, that's something that's being floated out there. I was sort of like, are you kidding me?
Sandra, make it go away.
Huh?
Make it go away. That's it.
Oh. Well, did you get that article I sent you about the girl that robbed that bank, though?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, my God.
No, that was, I mean, I don't mean to laugh. I don't even know why I'm laughing. See, that's where things are at. But I was like, damn, they ain't even found the girls. I'm like, have fun.
Yeah, a federal judge in Manhattan again allowed. Oh, darn, where's the link?
I think it's the English paper, the Telegraph.
Yeah, well, do the backstory real quick, because I'm trying to find the link.
Yeah, no, it's just the two girls. One was 13, and one was 14, and one was 12. And they went in and gave some teller a note, and they left with a bag of money. And last scene, man, they ain't been seen. They're gone. Last I heard, they haven't been found. It's funny because you can't find this story in a. Yeah. I haven't found it in the U.S. press at all.
But the idea of the cops not being able to find a 12-year-old.
That's what's great. I just think. I mean, what can I say? You know, this is what's going on. You got little ones robbing banks. I hope they don't get shot or anything, though.
I fear
for them.
Were there rubber Betty masks involved or anything?
I saw pigtails, Bob, pigtails.
Oh, my God.
And I was laughing. I thought, my goodness, you know. I don't know. That one just made me chuckle. I know they're in big trouble, but I laughed harder when I found out that the police had no idea where the hell they are. They were just heading towards an estate. So an estate, you know what that means. I mean, that's a project for us. They call it an estate in Europe.
Right, right.
So it's heading towards a project. I'm like, oh, they lost. Goodbye.
And the cops ain't going in there.
Oh, I don't know. You know, that's my feel-good story for the week. I'm in trouble. You understand?
Nowhere to go but up.
Oh, my God. And the other one that was my feel-good story was that lawsuit against them.
Yeah, that's the one I just opened.
Shut up. That one is killer.
Yeah, I saw that when it came in earlier, and I just thought, oh, my God.
Well, the thing about that that's more interesting is the ANC, which is interesting, when they first came in power, they had grand illusions of, you know, making the political and economic justice for everyone. But they got swamped by the Chicago Boys. And
they do get around, don't they?
And they unfortunately turned, you know, the economic reality of South Africa is disgusting. So it's interesting that they changed their mind and they decided to push this lawsuit ahead, you know?
And essentially it's a lawsuit against Daimler AG, General Motors, Ford, and IBM.
And IBM with their little computer cards and line up all the Jews. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm just like the IBM. I mean, it's the
but you know what?
Corporation.
It's the usual suspects.
They're so evil.
Well, they'll go wherever they see money.
Well, no, but it's just when you look at the history, it's like, God damn, Ford, you know, and IBM.
And still hasn't learned.
And it's still going on. It's just kind of like.
Well, and Daimler, for God's sakes.
Oh, I know. Ooh. It's just, yeah.
I mean, they've got a history. There was a learning curve you would think was traveled.
Well, no, but you know, and they have the nerve to try to say, oh, well, somehow they're not liable because a statute runs out on providing armament and vehicles to run black folks over. That statute runs out at some point. And I guess the judge just said, no. And it's funny the Supreme Court didn't even listen to it. Don't you think? I was surprised. I didn't even know this was making its way through the courts.
Is there stuff maybe that the court just doesn't dare touch?
Well, Maybe. Maybe it's just so egregious. You know how it's hard to find out the real deal. Maybe this one is just beyond the beyond.
Well, but then again, the motion to dismiss was based on an interlocutory appeal, and the court may very well have been said, you know, we're going to wait till this thing is completely done, and then we're going to kill all of it.
Okay. Yeah. See, I'm not that familiar with all the law stuff. I know you've been close to it, so. No, I'm okay. So you're saying that it could come to a bad, quick end, huh?
Well, yeah, it could get it, well. The court, I mean, if you consider the rats on the Supreme Court,
I know.
You know, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Scalia, they would rather kill it all outright than have it go back and be relitigated and relitigated. They want to kill it once and for all. I mean, that's the way those guys think.
Yeah.
Just going to say what it boils down to is they're using the Alien Tort Claims Act. You know, it's a 220-year law. They're using the Alien Tort Claims Act to try to impose some level of justice on, you know, Daimler AG, General Motors, Ford, and IBM for their support for the apartheid regime. And what's going on here, I think, is they're going to let the thing go as far as it can go. And then if there's a judgment in favor of the plaintiffs, then it'll go up to the Supreme Court and the rats will do their magic.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the international flavor of it is interesting, you know, especially the reversal of the South African government, which, I mean, I'd like to do some more research on that because that's really surprising in this day and age.
Well, the other thing you might want to do some research into, Sandra, is the Alien Tort Claims Act itself. Because that was used, a year, 2 years ago to haul Drummond Cole into a federal court for its support of anti-union death squads in the coal fields of Colombia.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I wonder if they're using that for...
Unfortunately, Drummond got off, but that is, there is a whole legal school of thought or movement, if you will, that is centered on achieving justice against predatory foreign corporations by using the Alien Tort Claims Act in American federal courts.
Huh. Wow. No, it's, I'm just so impressed to see any kind of movement international or national-wise on stuff like this because it's really important since it's everything is becoming transnational, you know.
Right, and the defense, well, and understand the corporate defense is always, we didn't do it, and even if we did, we was only following orders.
Well, yeah, no, exactly, and, you know, even throw in, yeah, it's just incredible, they're kind of super citizens, these corporations.
Jim Hightower, I used the phrase immortal corporations a couple of nights ago. And then I checked on my Facebook page, and lo and behold, there was Jim Hightower, and I hadn't seen it. You know, it's just kind of cool, kind of Jungian synchronicity stuff.
Right.
But there's, lo and behold, there's a Jim Hightower column that mentions immortal corporations.
Wow, yeah, no, because that is, I mean, it's a good way of framing it. Also, the only other one, did you see that one from that Republican that I sent to you? Robert Craig, what is his name? It was about the detainment of.
Craig Roberts. Yeah, basically, Osama bin Laden's chef is gonna stay in Guantanamo forevermore.
Well, it's that one, I forget his name. These are Americans who are being sort of held because they've been accused of providing stocks or whatever to Al Qaeda.
Oh God.
They're citizens. He was just making the argument that the spillover has, you know, started because they've been held on secret evidence the first time in a while or ever that Americans have been held on secret evidence.
Well, we're going to see more and more of it, I fear. The story that I was referring to is that Taliban guy who was nothing more than a fry cook and never fired a shot, and it's been held that, you know, yeah, he can be held at Guantanamo. He got his habeas hearing, and Judge Richard J. Leon told him to go back and rot in prison.
And this isn't the chauffeur.
No, this is the cook.
Okay, because, I mean, there's so many sort of low-level so-called people who, you know, have been subjected to the gulag. I can't keep up.
Yeah, the AP report says a Guantanamo Bay prisoner, this is the one you sent me, where I couldn't get the link to work at Raw Story.
Oh, yeah, no, that one is over the top. Yes, no,
yeah.
It's in the same vein, though, but the Paul Craig Roberts one is about I don't know where he's from, but he's Muslim, but he's an American citizen, and he's being held in a immigration detention type situation.
Well, I'll tell you what, though, you want to hear some brilliant legal reasoning? This will just knock your socks off, Sandra. So this guy says that he was never anything more than a cook for the Taliban. Never fired a shot in battle, and he's been rotting in the concentration camp at Guantanamo ever since. And so he got a habeas petition up under the Boumediene decision that allows these guys to challenge their detention in court. Remember the right wing said that this would cause America to just, you know, all our Walmarts would be in smoking, just nothing more than smoking heaps of rubble.
Oh, wow.
You know, if they got habeas protection.
Oh, right.
So this guy files his habeas. His name is Ghaleb Nasser al-Bihani. He was an assistant cook. I mean, you know, he wasn't even the executive, the Taliban executive chef. He was, you know, he was just the sous chef. And apparently cooking for the Taliban renders you an enemy combatant, according to U.S. District Judge Richard J. Leon. And here's that legal reasoning. I mean, I don't know what law school you go to come up with this kind of crap. I mean, I think this guy sent a matchbook in and got a law degree. This is a quote. I'm not kidding. After all, as Napoleon himself was fond of pointing out, an army marches on its stomach.
Oh, no, and then I went and looked at the picture. I'm sorry to go superficial. What does that freak look like?
Oh, yeah. Richard J. Leon apparently marches on his.
Leon, there's really no need to talk about a stomach. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, this is a beautiful thing. He was under George H.W. Bush. He was, he was a member of the President's Commission on White House Fellowships. Then he was chief minority counsel on the October Surprise Task Force of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And then eventually he gets nominated to the bench by George W. On September the 10th, 2001.
Is he the one that said he had to release some, when people shocked me, he said he has to release some of the prisoners, or is that the wrong one?
I'm not sure. He says that, for instance, this is a quote of his about what enemy combatant means. He said, "We are here today, much to my dismay, I might add, to deal with a legal question that in my judgment should have been resolved a long time ago. I don't understand, I really don't, how the Supreme Court made the decision it made and left that question open. I don't understand how the Congress could let it go this long without resolving." You know, and he's a judge. That's what you're there for. Yeah, just another lazy-ass Republican doesn't want to do his job, and instead he winds up issuing phony quotes from Napoleon as the basis for denying habeas corpus relief.
To
an assistant cook.
It's just incredible. I mean, as if that's something that you should be quoting some, you know, crazy general.
Right. Well, you know, the theory is that when you issue a legal opinion, it's supposed to be grounded in legal theory, not something you saw on Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
No, it's true. I mean, I just sort of am kind of reeling from just that quote. It's like, wow, you know, especially what you're dealing with is sort of ability for the court to just arbitrarily detain people. I mean, that's what we're talking about, right?
Right. Well, Leon said in his opinion, according to the AP story, it is not necessary to fire a weapon against the United States or its coalition partners to be considered an enemy combatant. And he also went further and said al-Bihani's service in feeding the forces is more than enough to fit the definition.
Okay, so now we're just entering this in this land of Kafka for sure.
We really are. I mean, this is, you know, this is the trial. This is Kafka. This is Camus. This is nuts.
Well, the main reason why I sent that Craig Roberts article is he did a quote from Thomas More. I have to tell you, he says, Thomas More cautions against cutting the law down in order to chase after devils. But with the law cut down, where do we stand when the devil turns on us? I was like, damn, not Thomas More. You know, I had to be subjected to utopia, which drove me crazy, but I thought that quote was quite good.
Well, because sooner or later, they teach you so many bullshit phrases in law school, things like, it's a matter of whose ox is getting gored. And I know, ox, you know, I hadn't seen an ox since and I'm getting oxen in law school, but it's true. This is that convoluted, sick, twisted school of legal theory that says, the ends justify the means.
Yeah. No, that's what you get when you get people like you and these other freaks writing memos to sort of quickly rationalize it away, but I just think that, you know, Hedges and all these other people, this guy, you know, are sort of like warning, you know, with the how it's going to slip over. And Hedges goes so far as to say this is going to be used to quell, you know, economic uprising. Which,
well,
you know,
yeah.
I think, you know what I mean? I think that's the...
And by the way, Andy just wrote in from New Jersey, sort of expanding on the healthcare discussion you and I were having. He says those with health insurance policies from $8,500 to $23,000 get the 40% tax. And then notes attack the middle class. One-fifth of households after 6 years will be subject to this tax. Higher copays and deductibles along with less care. What a bargain.
Oh, yeah, no.
$8,500 to $23,000. There's nobody that has employer-provided health care that isn't in that bracket already, is there?
Well, a family, the way I read it was $23,000 for a family of four is a tax, and for single is $8,500. But I told you a month ago that in California they expect individuals to pay $23,000 within a decade.
Right.
Hello.
And the other part of that is that is something that that Bob Herbert wrote about in the New York Times that Andy reminds me of, and he says that in 3 years, the Cadillac tax implementation would capture 20% of all workers with employer-provided health. That's 3 years, Sandra. It'll affect
2016.
That's 31 million people. In 6 years, the tax would affect one-fifth of all households. Earning between $50,000 and $75,000, and the tax, you know, 40. But the thing is, it's not even going to recover the monies that they project that it will, because they're also predicating this on the idea that any savings in health care that employers get will be turned back to the employees, which is just, you know, acid-driven lunacy.
Right, no, that's a joke, because it's not. I mean, that's the thing, and for them to make those assumptions like that, it's just a joke. I mean, in economics, that's the problem that I have with economics, is that the fantasy world of models and assumptions, you're like, yeah.
Well, yeah, there's that old joke about the engineer and the economist marooned on a desert island, and they've got this crate of canned goods. Washes up and they can eat, but they don't have a can opener. And so the engineer goes off and he starts trying to design a can opener that'll open the cans, and he's describing his idea to the economist, and he looks at the economist and he says, what about you? What's your idea? And he says, imagine a can opener.
Well, yeah, you know.
I mean, it's a little flat, but it's the real fantasy world of the economists.
Well, no, it's totally true, because that is exactly what goes on. It's like, I can't tell you how many classes I've been where I'm trying to understand some you know, trade model. I'm like, how many assumptions are there again? There's about 20. I'm like, good night.
Yeah, not any of which are grounded in anything that you and I would recognize as reality, Sandra.
Well, certainly God. But so I just, you know, yeah, I don't even mean to go on that. I just am sort of thinking about economics and just like, it's so, I'm not too sure how useful, well, obviously it's really not that useful. Look at the mess we're in.
Well, that's true. Hey, Sandra, we've got a whole bunch of blinkers here.
Okay,
this has been a great conversation.
That's great. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, take care. Bye now. 26 minutes before the hour, and I think we can get through some of these. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's Brian from New Hampshire.
Hey, Brian, what's up?
You know, Sandra, I know she called, she talks a lot about the health care. She's concerned about that, rightly so. Nancy Pelosi, where, you know, she's taken the shot at Barack Obama. I still haven't heard a specific point where she said he actually lied on some specific point about campaign.
No, and nor will she.
But she's still defending Nancy Pelosi wrongly, and I, for people like Sandra, people like myself, all Americans, Pelosi is still defending these damn closed-door health care negotiations, Bob, and that's the kind of thing, the policy towards the American people that destroyed the Hillary and Bill Clinton in 1993-94 and the Harry and Louise ads and all that, and they're letting themselves be set up for another 94 election with low turnout and the Republicans and they're born again.
Well, and that's the question, Brian.
No, practice cases seize the election. You know, it's not really an election. It's because they try to get people as sickened as they can with the political process. But
they can't be this politically tone deaf. They've got to know that this is a poison way to go about it.
Yeah, they know it. But the fact is, I'm looking for the article where they said, even the people in Congress, they, not my two Democrats here in the congressional representatives here in New Hampshire. We won back in the class of 2006, the House for New Hampshire. But the fact is, too many even Democrats, they get this royalist treatment there and corporatists and lobbyists to treat them like royalty, and they get this elitist idea. But both Paul Rhodes and Carol Safe Porter don't take a dime from corporations for their campaign contributions, all from the people. And also, in talking about that, Carol Safe Porter, the front page of the Republican newspaper here in New Hampshire, I used to be the Manchester Union hater, I mean the Manchester Union leader, the New Hampshire Union hater. I mean, the New Hampshire Union leader.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. They right on the front page. They've gone after this poor, good woman there. Great. She really cares for the people, for the rest of us, as she's always said in her campaign. She lived up to those words, to try to get back and try to protect the Social Security surplus, to try to protect, get a living wage for American workers. She's fighting in there. And again, for the Fourth Amendment rights and privacy, all Americans, Shea Porter, privacy, Trump security, Carol Safe Porter and Paul Rhodes argue for limitations on whole body imaging. You know, these new scanners that they want to put in there, but, you know, that Michael Chertoff has been big with those companies there that put 300 new full body scanner machines there.
That whole thing just makes me nuts, Brian.
More, less sexually open. They all look pretty private on what the scanners show here and the Transportation Security Administration photo here. But she's against the scanner, she said, but she's not completely against it. She says she's always said this is a two-pronged argument that the Republicans don't have a response to because it's on the facts. But she's always said that the people need to, if the metal detector is ringed or if somebody's on a terror watch list, they first of all, they probably shouldn't get on the flight, but they should be scanned. And if they ping off the metal detector, they should be scanned, the full body scanner. She wasn't against it. But also she said this repeatedly, and this is going back, I'm going back to story here, late 2003, early 2004, I guess mid to late 2003, Tom Ridge, then the Homeland Security Secretary, Bob, he's asking for $41.3 billion for the Homeland Security Department, and he got more, but George W. Bush's imperious presidency, he got more than that from Congress for Homeland Security that year for 2004 fiscal funding. And yet, in 2004 and 2005, repeatedly, though I disagree with what their official story is, the 9/11 Commission, they said repeatedly that full body scanners, it should be a part of it. It's one of the front lines in our airport security for fighting off terrorism. They were, you know, you can have debates about the Fourth Amendment of privacy, but the fact is they recommended that full body scanners be put in the airports back in 2004. George W. Bush sat on it for years, and they just were paying off people to put in plans, his corporate buddies, but they never put in the hundreds of scanners that were needed way back then. For years, they've not had this protection under Republican rule.
Well, of course, it's a lot easier just to give the money away without expecting anything to be done. But there's troubling stuff underneath all of this, And that's this. You know, there was this, and I think I've mentioned this a couple other times, Brian.
Yeah.
See, you talk fast, and then you make me talk fast. And
oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. You're just catching. That's all. But, you know, we have this study out about CT scans and the massive cancer clusters that will be happening in America in about 20 years or so.
Yep.
Now, X-ray, you know, you don't just go get an X-ray for the hell of it.
Right.
Because
there's a long-term health effects of these things. There are also,
yes.
If somebody's a frequent business traveler or that kind of thing, what's it going to do to their... Are they going to be as toxified as somebody a cleanup at Ground Zero or as a coal
right.
miner with the asbestos, the coal? You know, what's going to happen to them? And also, these right-wing moralists, what about the child pornography laws when you're going to have a full-body scan of a child going through these airport security? Because, you know, if the story is true, and these Al-Qaeda enemies, they'll plant a bomb on a soft individual, like, you know, like a child. They'll even plant the bomb on a child if that'll get him through and onto the plane. They'll do that. And you know damn well if the full body scanners, they would have to be put on children too. And
yeah, but Brian,
have child pornography laws. What
you're
about
you're absolutely right about that. I mean, the government in the UK is having to deal with that because the full body scans are a direct violation of all the kiddie porn laws in the UK. But let me back up. I got to be careful about saying back up. I got Juanita got me the other night. But we'll pull it back just a little bit.
Okay.
If you know. Any busy airport that the metal detector scanning area is a total cluster. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a mess. There's tons of people taking off their shoes, starting their laptops, taking out their cell phones and the batteries. It's just crazy.
Yet another Bush administration feckless response to the Richard Reid shoe bomber.
Right,
going after Obama for trying to, they put this guy right up in the civilian criminal court charges for life imprisonment, this young Nigerian guy. But that's exactly what George Bush did. He took him more than a week to do it, too, to file.
But wait, work with me.
Charges in the civilian courts against Richard Reid.
Work with me here for a minute, Brian.
Okay, go ahead.
So we're going to pull back for a minute, and we've just sort of painted a little thought picture of what these checkpoints look like.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to give anybody any ideas, but I think they're probably as smarter than I am.
Those ideas are out there anyway.
If that's the case, then you don't have to blow up the plane anymore. You can set off the bomb at the checkpoint and do the same damage.
Right. And
so you don't even have to go through the full body scanner. It doesn't have to be a man, a woman, or a kid. You just do it right before you get to it.
Right, and that could be another target if they really escalate this war by invading Yemen with our Saudi Arabian allies and the American base there. We're making more and more Al Qaeda.
Yes, and so we get
they'll attack those machines. They'll blow them up, and that'll be much more expensive for us to replace it. But the war profiteers will love it.
But we get wrapped into this feedback loop of pulling back and pulling back and pulling back, trying to figure out some way to keep the terrorists from getting to our sensitive locations. We don't want them on the plane, so they'll blow up they'll blow up the checkpoint. We don't want a checkpoint, they'll blow up the front of the airport. And so it's, you know, it's that whole feedback loop of better mouse, better mousetrap, better mouse, better mousetrap. Okay?
Right.
All the while, never bothering to stop and doing the actual skull sweat work of figuring out why the sons of bitches are coming here in the first place.
Right, that's it too. And doing the actual, like the actual security work, the criminal science work, and the actual national security work. There was plenty of warnings. They could have nabbed this guy and detained this Nigerian guy long before. They had been following him since August 2009. His father had been warning the American and Nigerian embassies and officials, and they had been following him in Yemen. This Nigerian was supposed to be this, and they knew exactly who it was. They somehow, I believe, like Mike Malloy is saying, that somehow stand down orders were they allowed this guy to get through, and that's what President Obama himself was alluding to last night. He was politely saying, in his Harvard Law School intonation, but still, the heads are going to roll, and it may not be this phony wrestling talk, these Republicans on the corporate news meter, it may not be Janet Napolitano that had anything to do with it. It's got to be somebody much lower than her anyways that would have the control to put this guy on the watch list, no-fly list, to detain this guy if he ever wants to take a flight into the United States or into England wouldn't allow him in. You know, what's up with that? I thought we always work closely with MI5, with the English intelligence, and they wouldn't allow this guy in for good reason. there's something up with that, and Obama was alluding to that last night. He was sounding very angry. He was sounding like a leader for the first time in a long time, and maybe in his entire presidency, it's sad to say. As much as I can't stand Ronald Reagan in the history of America and what he's done, he always set, and he had the lapdog media, he always could set the agenda, Bob. He always could set the agenda for the national news and media from his White House office and from his spokespeople and himself. His own way, and even he's compared to George W. Bush, Ronald Reagan was Winston Churchill, but even George W. Bush, the commander guy, could always come across, he could always come across as a leader and actually get mad, and you could, at the same time, you could come across, people could see that guy is actually the commander in chief. The first time I saw that in Barack Obama, really, was last night. What he's talking about, that, you know, the heads are going to roll, was what he's basically saying. He's a thinking leader, though, too, and that's the kind of leader you're going to need to really win over 1.3 billion Muslims after the disastrous presidency of George W. Bush. Absolutely.
I know.
I'm tired of all of this, too, Bob. The lies and the feckless Democrats are part of the problem, but they... At the same time, like, you can't throw them all out. Like I say, Carol Shea Porter and Paul Hose here in New Hampshire, they're two good progressives, and all over the country there are good progressive Democrats. They just are not in the leadership. And these corrupt people, these corporatists like Steny Hoyer and Pelosi and the feckless Harry Reid, they are destroying, you know, they are fulfilling what Ronald Reagan said. I never agree with him on anything. He was lying because he was paid off by the privatizing corporations and Ayn Randians, social Darwinists of his time. He was inspired by Milton Friedman. And like you were just talking about Governor Arnold there, he loves Milton Friedman and the libertarian. He hates the poor. He hates the underclass. He hates the lower working class. Arnold Schwarzenegger is social Darwinistic. He hasn't lost that big bully of his father, Nazi Party captain, his father in Austria, the Austrian army, then to become the German army after the onslaughts was. He hasn't lost that bullying attitude, and that's why he loves Milton Friedman and the Ayn Randian social Darwinistic scapegoating economics and class-conscious economics, that everything goes to the rich, everything. Capital gains are never taxed. They try to make capital gains into something productive instead of the people that actually build our cars, that actually build the Humvees to protect our troops. They'll build up armored Humvees if the damn defense contractors will design them properly. American workers are the most productive on Earth. That's because they get screwed the most by these corporatist bastards. They need to change the corporate charter, for God's sake. But the fact is that Ronald Reagan, he said that, you know, he wanted to cut down on, the government. He that's what he was saying. It was a good thing to do. And really the privatization of our armed services too started under him too. Some of these Halliburton, Bechtel, and they had corrupting influence on their LBJ too. It was both parties are too much in pay and they're servants to.
You know what you've got. You've got way too good a handle on all this, Brian. You really,
but
really
the fact
do.
Is Ronald Reagan said the one thing he said was, you know, what that I in most cases where he was trying to make that example, I disagree with Reagan. He was making a phony argument to please the corporatists and the elitists. But he always said that the nine words or whatever you got to fear. I'm here from the government and I'm here to help you.
Yeah.
Well, that's what this health care bill is all about, Bob. With their secretive behind the closed doors negotiations, they're letting people like Sandra out of the loop, and the American people deserve to be in the loop.
Well, I agree.
That's
and,
right.
And frankly, you know, from a political standpoint, they could say, hey, you know, it's on. What are the Republicans complaining about? They're not participating. It's on C-SPAN. They can watch it.
Republicans don't have any role in that. They tried to destroy. They profiteer from health care. That senator from, you know, from, what was it, Bill Frist from Tennessee?
Yeah,
the Dr. Fritz, the cat killer there. His Hospital Corporation of America, they profited, overcharged the American taxpayer of the billions, Hospital Corporation of America, HCA.
Oh, yeah, and recently, you're going to love this.
They still, the Medicare and Medicaid still have the lowest administrative costs, the government health care, 2 cents per dollar per administrative cost. The private insurance can be anywhere from 20 cents to 45 cents per dollar spent in administrative costs for
right.
the profiteering CEOs and the rest.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt of the truth of what you speak, but I got to roll on, my friend. Going to try to catch a couple more blinkers here.
I'll try to take decaf before my next call.
Yeah, that decaf's good. Decaf's good. just breathe, Brian. Breathe.
Yeah, that's right. And also that one other thing, informationclearinghouse.info, the number of Iraq's Iraqis that died in the war so far since March of 2003. It's apparently, according to the Lancet, the British, the updated Lancet British Medical Studies, 1,366,350, and it's by that, you know, that very scientific study.
Yeah.
This is the number of people who have been lost. I don't think that even includes the depleted uranium people.
No, no, it doesn't.
Another story on Bhopal, too, about the Union Carbide, the meltdown there, that it's like you people are going through there in coal country. These corporate charters have got to be, they have to be overthrown.
And they will someday when the American people get sick enough of it and decide to get off their asses and away from their TVs. Brian, you have a great night, my friend.
Okay, good night.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
From New Hampshire, that's Brian. And you know, someday, because I will not hurry Brian off the air. And we're, you know, one of these days, Brian's going to have decaf before he calls, and we're going to have, you know what? I know what we need to do. Brian needs a southern vacation. He needs to sit on a porch somewhere with the sun setting in the deep south, and then just relax a little bit and. Yeah, I love Brian. I do. Let's see what's going on here. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, Bob.
Well, hey, Bob.
Hey, it's Bob from North Dakota. And it is frigid up here. It's really cold. I got to ask that.
Yeah, well, how cold? I mean, I think we're cold here. How cold is it there, Bob?
13 to below zero, normal temperature, but it ain't that got cold up. I almost said GD cold. Yeah.
Colder than a well digger's ass.
Yeah, kind of like that. But, hey, think for a moment. When it gets cold, you just slow down. Slow down. Okay? Take a moment and think. Your molecules, or whatever, your atoms. That's all. Down. Settle down. I think that's what your daddy told you. Not time, Bob. Think about it.
You're right.
Settle down, son.
Breathing, letting go, relaxing. Yep.
No, not breathe, not relax. He said, settle down.
Well, he did say that some, too.
Nice and easy. He said, settle down. It's enough. It's time to take a stand. I've told you that before many times, but nobody ever listens because they're all bubbling up. I'm saying, settle down, people. Take a stand. Think about it for a moment. Just one moment, my beloved children, think about it. It's not you, Bob Kincaid, or me, Bob, here in North Dakota. It's not about me or you. It's about us. It's about us, Bob. The people, all these beloved children of ours, those that you love, those that I love, I do care about you. And that's why I call you a good son. That's why your father thought of you as that. A good son. Because you don't think about Bob Kincaid there in West Virginia or Bob here in North Dakota or whatever. You don't care about individuals, me, you, the other. You think about those children, those Iraqis that we've destroyed. I think about them. I grieve for their father, for their mother, brothers, sisters, and those that we have created against us. You and I, Bob Kincaid, we have created denied under George Bush or Barack Obama or whatever. Go back far enough, you'll get back to my nemesis. Okay? His name was Nixon, Richard M. Nixon.
Or as Harry Truman called him, Richard Pinhead Nixon.
Yeah, that is the truth. And my friend, dear Bob, to you and Agnes and your children, I send you this, my most humble apology for being a liberal progressive that does not just stand by and kiss everybody's behind that passes, okay?
Yep.
I just see what I see, and I say what I believe to be truth, because I've been there, son. I've been there. I have murdered people in your name, because you are an American citizen. I have murdered people in your name, but I have never forgiven myself. See, there's the difference. I can't forgive myself for doing your bidding, but you can't even see that you sent me there. And that's the truth.
Or allowed you to stay.
No, you don't even allow me to be. You call me what? Okay? A disgruntled postal worker or whatever. Hey, what do they call him, guys? He went postal. Okay? I went postal long before you were born. But your father knew me because he did too. But he held it in because that was his generation. My generation said, no more, no more. It's enough. But the next thing, what'd they do? They kicked us to the curb. They beat us with baseball bats at Miami. They treated us like they treated the veterans from that other war. The one before the Vietnam War. Everybody forgets Korea.
Yeah, there was that little dust-up, wasn't there?
There was. But those boys, they fought a war against the Chi-Coms, okay? The Chi-Coms.
I seem to recall there was a long march involved somewhere along the way.
Yeah.
In freezing cold. Hey, Bob, I've got to cut it short because we are at the end of things. But it's good to hear from you, my friend. And
think me a fool, call me a fool, but I am no coward. I can't let that go. I cannot let that go. Your father did his best, his nature. I did mine. I am no coward. Don't ever call me that. I can't accept it.
I don't think anyone ever would, Bob. Take care and give our best to Glenda.
Yeah, and love to Agnes and your beloved children. They are mine too. And believe me, people, you have to stand up for something, even if you're not recognized. And if you don't like it, well, tough. It's something you gotta do. If you love your family and your friends, as I love you, Bob, and your family, and that's this head-on radio network family, every GD one of you. I love you. I care about you. And I don't agree with you all the time, but I know you are worth fighting for. Dang it.
And that's the bottom line, isn't it, Bob? Got to roll, my friend. We'll talk to you soon.
Be well.
Take care. Bye now.
Love you. Bye-bye.
That's our brother Bob. up on the high plains of North Dakota. Time to roll on. What a night it has been. Thank you all for joining in. Thank you for your thoughts, your emails, your phone conversations. Thank you for listening and paying attention to some of the most important science to come out in a very, very long time, especially as relates to those of us here in the hills and hollers of almost America, Appalachia. Thanks to John Fox, to Peter Godbold, to Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you all. Continuing thanks go to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, and all of those who stand up against the horror that is mountaintop removal. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Chat On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome along, everybody. We are going to jump right to the chase this evening. I have on the line with me right now, graciously agreeing to have a conversation with us about a very, very, very important thing that has happened today. An absolutely stunning study has been announced. It has been published in the peer-reviewed journal Science. And the fact of the matter is, what this study indicates is that mountaintop removal is pervasive. It is irreversible. And this is real science. This is the undeniable stuff. And I have several of the co-authors of the study online with me now. I want to go straight to them so that we waste no time whatsoever. On the line with me now is Dr. Margaret Palmer. Dr. Palmer, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. Also with us, Dr. Michael Hendricks, Dr. Emily Bernhardt, and Dr. A.D. Lemley, all of whom had a hand in the creation of this study. Dr. Palmer, and each of you, when you speak, if you would just identify yourselves, please. Let me ask you first, Dr. Palmer, how did such a comprehensive study take shape and come to be?
Well, all of the authors are very dedicated scientists who have expertise in specific areas that are relevant to the issue of mountaintop mining. And it became clear to myself and to my close collaborator, Dr. Bernhardt, that the relevant science related to the issue of mountaintop mining had not been brought together in a way that could deeply analyze what was available out there, what we know and what we don't know, using the peer-reviewed literature. And so we contacted those experts from hydrology, toxicology, public health, et cetera, that could work together to analyze existing data and anything that had been peer-reviewed to ask, what do we know about the impacts of mountaintop mining environmentally and in terms of health, if there are impacts, and what would we find? And so we set out to do that. It took us about 6 months to complete the analysis of the existing peer-reviewed studies, as well as to analyze a recently obtained data set that we had on water chemistry.
Was there a great deal of data out there for your analysis in terms of those pre-existing peer-reviewed studies?
It depends on which aspect of the issue that you look at. There is a fairly extensive amount of data available on water chemistry that has not been brought to the forefront to a large extent in some of the more accessible peer-reviewed literature. But much of this information exists in very different sources, again, all of the peer-reviewed science journals, that had not been brought together, and that is essentially what we did with this particular study.
Well, since this does bring together so many different fields, Dr. Palmer, if you would sort of take the lead on this and guide us through the process of what you've discovered, let's start with your particular field of expertise, and then we will move to Dr. Hendricks, Dr. Bernhardt, and Dr. Lemley, because what I get from reading this is that there is no aspect of anything that was studied within your research that mountaintop removal does not have